Good evening and welcome to the Revelations Radio Network, Revere Radio Network, iTunes, various podcast sites. This show is called Nowhere to Run. My name is Chris and I'm happy to be here with you. I really am happy to be here with you. It's been about 2 weeks since my last show. It was not my intention to wait that long, but it's just been really busy around here, just been covered up, as they say here in the South, and I'm really glad to have this time to do the show. It's never my intention to wait any amount of time. It's just a lot of traveling, a lot of just absolute inability to get to the show, and of course the technical difficulties. Even today, I've been the last, I guess it's been about 2 hours now, trying to figure out new ways to record the show. But I think, as I've said before, I think I've actually got it figured out now, but we'll see about that next time I try, because it'll inevitably be some new thing. But anyway, I've got a lot of notes here that I could probably rant about either topic on these notes for a few minutes, so I'll just go down the list. I doubt it's going to be coherent in any way, but we'll give it a shot. First, I'm going to play some audio a little later, from an interview on the Alex Jones Show. He did an interview with the expert in genetically modified food that I find very, very interesting. It was a really good interview as far as information goes, so I have edited a little clip from that show, and I'll play that later. And I want to talk a little bit about genetically modified food. It's just, I know I've said before, I just think it's just so incredibly important that we realize that this stuff is not as safe as it's just being told that we are. I mean, we're not even really told anything about it. It's not real common knowledge that the food that we're eating at the grocery store is mostly genetically modified. And that's a true statement if you really are a label reader. Granted, they don't have to label anything as being genetically modified, to the best of my knowledge. I think that some of them do. You can turn around and most of the labels of the things you're eating will say modified starch, modified food starch, modified this, that, whatever. Some of them do put that, and if you do see that on a label, you'll know to put that back on the shelf and to go find something that doesn't say that. But you also have to know that if it has corn in it, you have a high percentage, I think it's in the 90s, of that corn being genetically modified. Same thing with soy. It has about that high percentage of it being genetically modified. Same thing with canola oil and cottonseed oil. So if you take just corn, soy, canola, and cottonseed, and most of the food at the grocery store has one of those things, if not all of those things, in it. And soy is just everywhere as well. I mean, you can't hardly find anything that doesn't have soy. Here's a really interesting story. This is not, we joke about this in the band. One time I got done telling everybody about how much genetically modified food and we should totally have tried to avoid it and whatever. But anyway, so that, one of the guys was looking on the back of his packet of mayonnaise and, you know, it says all kinds of nefarious stuff on the back of mayonnaise, modified this and that and whatever. And then it had a little asterisk by something. I don't remember what it was calling, but the asterisk said, and then you look down at what the asterisk meant on the bottom of the thing, and it said, ingredient not normally found in mayonnaise. Okay? But, okay, it's just, somebody had to, like, there was lawyers somewhere that said, we're going to have to put an asterisk by that because, I mean, and then they said, an ingredient not normally found in mayonnaise? I mean, why would you even say that? I mean, there's got to be some reason. But what I found funny and what we were laughing about last week is that eventually, because, I mean, they still got it in mayonnaise. It says that on the back of, I think it was Heinz mayonnaise or maybe it was Kraft. It was Kraft mayonnaise. And but I was thinking eventually they'll be able to take that off. There's probably a time period where they'll be able to take that asterisk off because it is an ingredient normally found in mayonnaise now, you know. So they'll be, it's like, and after 2 years of this being in mayonnaise, it then becomes normally found in mayonnaise, and then you get to take the asterisk off. I mean, I just thought it was funny. But what I'm getting at, I guess, is that the studies for this are really, really bad. You wouldn't even believe what they know is happening to the animals that are eating this stuff. And so we really, really have to pay attention to that, and that's why I'm going to play this clip at the end of the show. And it's just amazing. I mean, the animals won't even eat it. In most cases, in a lot of cases, they have to force feed the animals the genetically modified food because they won't eat it themselves. And a lot of farmers know this too. Apparently, that they have to mix certain genetically modified foods with sugar or something to get the animals to eat it. And that is should be a red flag to us as well. And another clip I'm going to play is from George Gordon, and it is to do with mineral deficiencies, and I think it's really important that people should know this. Every time I listen to George Gordon, there's always something else. I'm like, oh, man, that is another thing I did not know about that we should avoid, and it is most likely causing all kinds of problems, or in this case, not avoid, but rather seek after. But the gist of it is that it's not a vitamin deficiency. I mean, granted, I'm sure we have a good number of vitamin deficiencies, but we, at least in America, have a serious mineral deficiency, and there's no really avenue for us to get these minerals anymore because of the lifestyle and so on. But most of us have an affliction, I guess would be a good term for it, where it has a name, and I can't remember what it was, but basically it's this craving for snacks, salty things and also sweet things. This affliction is actually a result of the craving for these many minerals that we are deficient in. And it is temporarily relieved by the snacking of salty or sugary things. And almost everybody has it. And he goes on and explains about how this was reported, you know, early on in the 1900s, and there were severe cases and so on. And apparently, there are just any number of diseases that are completely wiped out with the proper minerals. And there's any number of minerals that we aren't getting. And salt is it doesn't even register on the thing. I'm sure even the salt that we have apparently is of no value whatsoever. There is a type of salt that you can get, like some kind of salt from the North Sea or something like that. It's like $22 a pound, where ours is like 20 cents a pound or whatever, just normal table salt. Essentially, there's no way to get these minerals except for a very practical method, and you can find it at your local co-op or farmer supply or whatever. Go get a mineral lick, or I don't know if it's the same thing as a salt lick, but it's I'm sure they would have both there if it is two things, and literally just lick it a couple times a day. I don't know how many times a day. I mean, really, that's as simple as it is. I mean, and I'm sure that wasn't that's about as easy of a solution as you can get, you know. I mean, getting a salt lick, I mean, going to carry a little mineral lick in your wallet, in your purse, your pocket, whatever. I don't know. It's a suggestion. I'll play that clip there because he makes a strong case, but he always makes a strong case for all this stuff. He did one I encourage you to listen to. I should put it in the show notes as well, about radiation from microwaves and what we know about that. Even when they're plugged in, it was just mind-boggling, the information about what microwaves are doing. And I'm telling you what, I'm going to have to stop listening to George Gordon at some point because of... Yeah, anyway, okay, moving on. I've got to get going here. I want to talk a little bit about something that I just think is really important, and I just have a soft spot in my heart lately for it, and I can't figure out why, and I just like it. But yeah, I was sent by an alert listener some information regarding Israel and stuff when I talked to, or actually played a clip about the Betrayal of the Chosen clip, and showing that a lot of what we think we know about Israel and what's going on with that conflict is complete lies, that the real history is so much different from the mainstream history and even the alternative mainstream history from almost all sides, that we're getting a lot of disinformation from that area. And it's really, really slick, and the reason that it works is because it's so slick. And I hope I'll be able to explain to you what I mean by that while I rant about this a little bit. But what I want to play for you, or I guess I'll just link you this in the show notes, and I really encourage you to check it out, is something, a movie called Pallywood, like Palestinian, but Pallywood. And it's really, really amazing because it shows how these, you know, very professional film crews get these sight bites, like, you know, sound bites, but sight bites for mainstream media or all media, alternative media, of, you know, Palestinians being oppressed and throwing Molotov cocktails and heated gun battles, these little just clips. And then they interplay that with, you know, like, I know the Palestinians today killed so and so and so many, and And when you look at the original footage, all that original footage and what they took out of context and how they did it and what all the stories around it, it's just, it's amazing. It, and that story goes a lot deeper than almost all of us believe, and that includes in the alternative conspiracy movement, because, and I think this is just such a huge problem, a smoking gun, that we're all smart enough to figure this out. I don't understand why all of a sudden, when it comes to that issue, when it comes to what is going on in Israel right now, we all of a sudden, and as much as we all know that the mainstream media has an agenda, is owned by the same families, has nothing but New World Order on their mind 24 hours a day, all of a sudden we just believe them implicitly when it comes to the Palestinian-Israel conflict. And that it goes specifically for the conspiracy people who think that they have this all figured out, and it's this whole pride factor that they have the whole New World Order figured out, that it's the same trap that are being led to do exactly what they're supposed to do. That we in the conspiracy movement have not given them enough credit. I mean, they're not that smart, but they're a lot smarter than we're giving them credit for. We have this idea that we know about all these things. We know about 9/11, and we know all this stuff in their history, and the history of this and whatever. We have got them figured out. Jordan Maxwell cracked the case for us, you know. We don't need to know any more about them. Yet, at the same time, they're using that prideful knowledge and pulling one over on us. But I'll try to get into that a little later. But let me just continue with that. You got to look at this movie just for that conflict alone. Let's just take this one piece and the mainstream media disinformation about that. Let's just say whatever is going on in there, whatever the history of it is, why are they faking all that stuff? I mean, it's a total fraud. It's right there. I mean, you can look at this original footage, and it's just a fraud. And then to see how 60 Minutes reports on it shows you that there's an agenda. And when you look at the UN and you look at all, the EU and all these organizations that hey, you know, they're probably in on this, you know, they're probably have an agenda, except they say the exact same things that Rents.com says, you know. And Rents is a good example of the entire conspiracy disinformation campaign. Rents.com will provide you with the best info, the most up-to-date. It is the best. It's one of the most top-rated sites in the world. I mean, it's right up there with, you know, eBay and the rest. Rents is mentioned by the State Department, which is basically an advertisement for it, in my opinion. I mean, the State Department called out and said, oh, these conspiracy theorists that they listen to these sites like Rents.com. Go to Rents.com. And here, they are mixing in this crucial information about the New World Order and the new news about this thing and that thing conspiracy. And at the same time, it's all intermixed with Zionist, caught doing Zionist things to Zionist, the big Zionist pigs and their Zionist ways, Zionist, Zionist, Zionist. I mean, it's the every fifth story. And then D's Illustration will do another thing with some propaganda. I mean, we watched the propaganda stuff. You guys remember seeing those propaganda posters from the Nazis, right? You know, when the Jews were, you know, these crazy, you know, monstrous things. Well, okay, now let me just back up a little bit. Now, how is that different than Rents.com, you know? Am I missing something there? I mean, we know everybody in our country now is Nazis from the Project Paperclip thing. I mean, we know that probably most of the people have some kind of, we find out through the chosen ones and the different multiple personality people that a lot of these people running the shows have Nazi altars, and just about everyone has a German-speaking Nazi loyal altar, and we can be reasonably sure that people in top levels of our government and, you know, in South America and as well, and probably all over the world, are still with this, and yet we won't believe that. We still think that we have it figured out and that the Jews are bad. Yet if you go to the UN webpage right now or any time ever, the first page, the first story will always be something about Israel. They are very, very focused on it. Regardless of what they want it for, I'm not going to tell you what, because I'm not sure I can put forth a theory, but I'll tell you this, they're very interested in it, always have been, and their stance is extremely pro-Palestinian. And I want everybody also to look into this lady, if you haven't already. And I got to say, this is also sent to me by the alert listener who I don't have his information here. And he's a really, really cool guy. And he sent me some information about Joan Peters, who wrote a book called From Time Immemorial. And she's just a really amazing lady. This book is like, it's a textbook. It's taught in universities and stuff as a textbook. It's the real history of Israel, and the fact that, I'm not going to get into this right now because there's just a lot of hate out there with it, but I'll just put it in the show notes and to tell you to please look into Joan Peters. There's a few video interviews with her, and I want you to watch them, and I would play them here, but I can't convert them. It's a long story. But I want you to believe this. What we've been told about the Israel conflict is not true. And you owe it to yourself to find out what the other side of the story is. Regardless of how fervent you believe in one area, you need to check out the other one. And I've been thinking a lot about that myself. I just had a guy do an expose. He said it wasn't an expose on me, but it was the rapture thing. And so I wanted to do that for myself. I was like, all right, well, let's just really look into this. I'm not going to take anybody's word for it. I'm just going to find every place in the Bible and see read it for myself and just start from ground zero and see what I think. And I'll do a show on that coming up. I really wanted to avoid talking about the rapture anymore because I just didn't want to turn it into rapture wars. But at the same time, you know, I don't feel like I've actually said what I wanted to say. This particular person, I'll talk about it in the next show when I do that. Let's move on a little bit. I want to talk about something that we could all do that I think that we could all just join in and do a little bit, because everybody's got their own thing, and I just really feel strongly about this, that there is something special here, and it's not, I don't have any kind of whole piece of this puzzle, and some of the guys on Revelations, you know, which is really great, man. I gotta just really give props to Revelations Radio Network. I'll talk about that in a little bit, but you know, those guys have a piece of the puzzle. We're not all right about everything. I guarantee you I'm wrong about a lot of stuff. But we've all got something, a piece of this puzzle. And I think that the more alert listeners and the ones doing diligent study and you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess you don't have to do diligent study. I think some people just, you know, can be led by the Spirit, and that's a good enough teacher as any, and probably better than all. And I just want to say that basically we are on the cutting edge of something that is going to be important, and I think that is very not very well represented in the either Christian or conspiracy avenues. And whichever one you're more geared toward, you might want to try to, I don't know if any of you have a burden like either I or Frank or the guys on Revelations do, but if you do, here are some ideas that I think that could really help kind of translate some of the core issues about what we talk about here. And I don't know what I'm referring to about that, I guess, but whatever it is that we're referring to here, whatever you feel strongly about, and translating it, making movies on YouTube is a very, very good thing. And there is still, to date, if you type in something about the Nephilim, there's not one movie on YouTube or Google that actually represents a fair idea of it. Most of them are New Age alien cult crap, you know? Most of them have nothing to do with any truth about the Bible at all. There are getting some more, but most of them don't. And it's not doesn't have to go to the Nephilim. It could be anything. But there needs to be people doing things like that on YouTube specifically. It's just this whole new realm of things going on YouTube. Very, very easy to make movies. I used to think, wow, I wish I could make movies. That's the one thing I couldn't do. I'll do these other things because I can't do that. And then just never realizing how simple it is to do, especially if you have Windows Movie Maker, and most of you do, it might not be obvious that you do, go to search in like your C drive or whatever and type in Movie Maker, and I bet if you're using Vista or XP or probably earlier versions, you have a version of Movie Maker, and if you do, just convert an MP3 file to a Windows media file, and just the only reason you have to do that is because it makes the sync up audio with the video, and just, you know, it makes it really easy if you're any kind of just basic computer programs, you'll be able to figure that out pretty quickly. If you need any help, you can email me. It's chris@conspiracyclose.com. But I think that's a really good avenue for some people. Also a good avenue would be, I was just thinking, writing tracts. Now, I know that's a Christian term, writing tracts, but I think that there is a new kind of tract, and it could be also for, there's so much that we all need to know, you know, that's a life and death situations are out here, you know, the food supply, the water supplies, poison, the vaccinations, we're in trouble, people. We got chemtrails, cloud in the skies, and everything is just really, really dire right now, and I don't know, I think that somebody out there is probably a good writer, and one thing I've wanted to do for a long time was just, I don't know how I would do it. I don't know how much I would want to say in one little thing, but if there was just a little handbill, you know, a little bill that you could put on people's car windows, you know, and just say, I mean, front and back, just print, especially if you're a printer or know a printer or whatever, entire front and back just of information, a track writer in that regard is needed. And if you do that and think of a good way to present any number of any of the things that everybody needs to know, and then, you know, go out and hand them out or go out and put them on car windows at Walmart, whatever. I think that's a way to wake up your general vicinity or whatever. Maybe not waking up, maybe, I don't know. I mean, or writing tracks for Christians specifically about, you know, the things that we need to know. And there's just a lot of things that Christians are going to be tried for. Again, I'm not really trying to tell you what to write on it, because that's all you. But I just imagine if you're listening to Revelations Radio Network and you're listening to this kind of thing, you probably think a little differently, and you don't really fit in with the conspiracy crowd or the Christian crowd. And I don't think a lot of people don't understand how in the middle of all this those that know about all this stuff are. But anyway, so I think that whatever your burden for is, whatever things you feel strongly about, these are just ideas. Another thing, obviously, is podcasts. I think that we've had a great success in people. We've basically taken over Podomatic. The Christian conspiracy theorists just about taken over Podomatic.com. And if you guys want to join in, it's the easiest thing to do. Start a podcast at Podomatic.com, Podomatic.com. Go there. It's free. And eventually you can pay if you want to have more space or more whatever, more bandwidth, but it's still cheap if you want to do that. But you don't even have to use it. You can just set it up. It's just like a MySpace page, essentially. If you're basically coherent and making, and you can record an audio file, then you can record a Podomatic. You might need just a few free programs. Like right now I'm recording on Audacity. I usually don't record on Audacity for a number of reasons, but as I've said, I've had some serious technical issues, but I actually like Audacity too. It's just a little more confusing for some people, I'm sure. But anyway, yeah, so, and then you can get on iTunes, which is really easy. Podomatic makes that simple as all get out. So that's one avenue that I think is just really, really helpful. Another one is, and this is something I do a lot, and I know people hate it when I do this, is when I'll do forum posts, and I basically am a member of a lot of conspiracy forums, and just because I like them, and also because I think it's a really good way to disseminate information to the target audience, which is the conspiracy people, which I want to inform about lies. You know, a lot of people think I'm a Jesuit and I got an agenda for all kinds of things. I've heard all kinds of stuff, but you know, my burden is for people not getting tricked by something that I am seeing that they're not. And I don't know why it's really easy, or it's not really easy. I mean, I guess I'm taking it for granted that I've been, you know, interested in this stuff for a while, and just really, really interested, and by nature of being interested, I look for the information and study a lot of it. I could be wrong, but I'm at least prolific in my search for it, so that's my burden anyway. Let me just talk about why I think forum posts really rock. Number one, it hits the search engines very easily, and it's not something you have to, if you put up a web page and put up an article there, then it's not going to be any kind of high on the search engines, but some of these major boards are already have very high rankings in Google, and so if anybody types in something, your article is already at the top of that page, you know? And so that's a really big, it gets a lot of exposure through that, alone. In addition, it's kind of like publishing it, you know? And the reason I think that it's like publishing is because of, if you do it and spread it out in enough forums, then that's on a lot of different servers that are independently upkept, and a lot of these people on these conspiracy forums really treasure their servers and the information that's on those forums, because somewhere in those forum posts is some truth, you know. Somebody has posted something true that's been overlooked, and they're going to be kept around for a while, even after Internet 2 and the rest of it. These things are going to have longevity. Now, if I just posted an article on my website and maybe somebody else's website, then all somebody has to do is take out my server, take out, you know, whatever, my local stuff, and there it is, bleeped off the screen. So it's kind of protection in that way as well. And also, it's good for the back-and-forth discussion. I think in the stuff that I do, it generates a lot of anger and hate, and I think that that's actually a good thing, because people that read through that and read through my responses to people, generally will say something like, hey, you know, I read through that, and I thought it was really illogical, all this hate, and I couldn't figure out why people were so strongly for this person or so illogically defending this idea or whatever. And so I think that actually helps people to understand that there is this decision, a willing decision for some people to be in the paradigm that they are. And you guys, you conspiracy people, know that. You know that good and well with the person who will not believe that 9/11 was an inside job, no matter how much you tell them about Building 7 or Fat Osama bin Laden or whatever. It doesn't matter. There's anger there. You see? You see that. You know that that kind of psychology exists, but you're unwilling to believe that it exists in your life with stuff that you believe. I know you can point back at me, well, what about you, Chris? You believe in this and that. I'm working on that, okay? I'm working on it. I'm gonna try to figure it all out. And this show has always been totally... I was just listening to a show the other day from 1229 or something like that. And this is 06, I think. So it was about, I don't know, 2 years ago. Has it been 2 years? It couldn't have been 2 years since I started doing the show, but anyway. I was listening to it. I guess it wasn't 12. I guess that's right at the end of the year. So I think it started 11, so whatever. Anyway, so you get my point. I was off. I was talking about... I was pretty loose about it and leaving the door pretty open, but I believed things that I don't believe now about some crucial issues, and that is... And I was going to take it off the server, but I was like, well... You know, there's also some good information there, and I think that as long as I'm open, and I think most of my shows have been, I did a lot more at the beginning where I do corrections every show, but, you know, I just want you to know I'm wrong, and I'm learning this with you. I think that's what makes this show unique, is I'm not trying to tell you how it is so much as giving you where I'm at. You know, I'm with this with you guys, and we're trying to figure out what this whole thing is all about, because... it's in need of figuring out. So we're all out here hunting and looking, and I'm just here with you. So this show is an update in that regard, okay? What was I talking about? Oh, yeah, let me continue. That's forums. And then, of course, this is the big one. What we can all do, regardless of if we do any of those things, is prayer. We need to pray. And this goes for everybody that's just kind of on the border with this, those that are really sold out for God, and everybody in between needs to pray all the time for everything, period. But in addition, prayers for this deception, prayers to expose these liars, these people who are intentionally deceiving people, and they're deceiving people away from the only thing that can beat them, the only thing that can save them. And I know that sounds like Christian rhetoric until you understand the mechanics of this situation. This is direly important. It just always perplexes me that we all know, you know, through the Bohemian Grove and all the various things, the skull and bone stuff, that and anything that if you've done any kind of search and on the Masons and whatever, I mean, it's really limitless. Every avenue leads back to these people are dark workers of magic, occultists, believe in something that is a source of their power. It appears to me, and it probably appears to anybody else that has diligently studied anything to do with the secret societies, that at the certain levels, they don't tell them the object of their desire, if you will. It is only at the higher levels, and I think that they really reveal to them the nature of their power, and at that point is when Luciferianism kicks in. Here is the action. Okay, you've made it to this level. We're going to tell you now that actually the source of our power is Lucifer, which then allows them the one spiritual thing that seems to be the most powerful, which is worship. So then they can worship Lucifer openly, because beforehand all the little occultic practices and whatever, you're just doing little tricks, Nephilim given provided tricks, and they've taught us how to do it because it opens doorways for them. It's a totally self-serving practice. They throw you a bone every now and again, but at the top levels of this, when they actually reveal it's Lucifer, they throw the Luciferianism in, which shows them at that level, look, this is their good guy. Actually, Lucifer, yeah, he's the source of our power, yet he's the good guy, and Adonai, he's the bad guy. And that's a real common theme with those that are let in on the secret. So they can still be true believers. Like, oh my gosh, we were doing all these rituals to Lucifer all the time? Yeah, 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 you were, but don't worry about it. He's actually the good guy. And that will allow, I mean, well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that the highest form of spirituality is worship. I know you would think by hearing just about everybody today, you would think that spirituality is just simply having to do with spirits. You know, you channel a spirit, you meditate and get information. Hey, you know, that was supernatural, that was real, that was spiritual. That wasn't spiritual, you just, you know, ran into a spirit. In fact, what is the most powerful part of this is worship, and that's where I say is such an important part of our lives and prayers, not just to pray, but also to worship, because there you're releasing this tool, this gift that we have in order, and our free will is ultimately who are we going to give this power to, and that's this power of our worship. Now I could be wrong about that, because I don't really know if there's any scriptural basis for that. There might be, but. So I'll give a caveat that this is probably opinion, but I do feel like worship is the thing sought after by this other side, and ultimately that's what this whole system is going to be about. It's like the reason the Antichrist is embodied by whoever it is that he's embodied by, this high level evil entity, be it Lucifer, be it if Abaddon is that, I don't know. They want to force everybody to worship him. You know? That's what it was all about. They needed a new world order set up and a worldwide economic currency as just a means. That's not their plan. What would they do if they got it? That's what I always wonder what people think about. The whole plan is just to get us into one world government and a one world currency, and then they'll just stop, and once they get us chipped, they're like, okay guys, we can all settle down and stop killing them. We got what we wanted. Let's start being nice again. I mean, they've got another plan besides that, and if you can also see that these people have a very interesting, intriguing preoccupation with our spirituality, and to be more precise, the anti-Christian, they're very anti-Christian, and that's just on paper. You know, that's not me being paranoid. And, you know, it's evidenced by everything our history is saying that we will refuse to believe. Some people will fight you tooth and nail saying that Christians have never been killed before. I mean, they're taking it to such extremes in their beliefs. Like, you know, I mean, I won't get into that. But let's just say any reasonable people can assume that, or, you know, assume, but see that we've been persecuted and never really stopped, and that that this is continuing now, and freedom of religion is really only going to be of value to Christians because they're the ones in danger. Because there's been such propagated hate, and we just eat it up in the conspiracy world and in secular world. Everybody loves to hate Christians, and it doesn't make any logical sense. I mean, look, you dangle in front of the public's face enough of those, that woman on that, you know, that crazy woman and Jesus camp and all that stuff enough times, just shoving it down in people's throats, you're going to, I mean, but it's, that kind of thing has been constantly going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. Let me give you an example of something I saw on a comment on the Zeitgeist Challenge thing, and it really illustrated what the net result of Zeitgeist is doing. And not just Zeitgeist, but the entire, everything that Zeitgeist referenced, the Jordan Maxwell books and the HRES and all these primary sources that they quoted in order to get that. And I hate it when people are like, look, it's on their website. That's how, that's, I mean, obviously, those aren't primary sources. If you want to quote me saying this right now, George Washington was a space alien, okay? Now, you go write a book about George Washington being a space alien, and you can reference this podcast, Nowhere to Run 3-1808, and you can reference it and put it in your bibliography that George Washington was a space alien, and then you'll have proof. Then you will have referenced it, and it'll be a primary source. I am now your primary source for George Washington being a space alien, okay? Everybody got that? That's my point, is that I won't go into that, which I just did, so I guess I will. Anyway, what this comment said was, and again, if you understand the drive for what they've been shoving down our throats very subtly for a while, is that all this is the fault of religion. Religion is at fault here for all the problems of the world, including the Illuminati and everything else. It's all been religion. It's the main enemy. And this kid said on this comment thing, I think YouTube is just, the reason people are so hate-filled is because of the anonymity factor. They don't really have to have much accountability. Less, actually more so than Google, I think, because I think you have to be registered. Besides the point, this kid says, this is the same kind of thing, I forget how, what it was specifically, but it was, this is what the world's problem is, and we're never, these, since the last 2,000 years, you know, this new world order, whatever, whatever. And I just thought, 2,000 years, I mean, they're blaming this, they're blaming everything on Jesus, is what it comes down to. This new cult is blaming all of the world's problems in Jesus. They're putting it in the Jesus locker. Let's just sweep it in there. We got another problem. What is it? Oh, it's a cancer. Put it in the hate against Christians. We'll try to find a way to make Christians to blame that for that. All the wars, any war that's going on is now the fault of religion, Christianity, and we can be sure that. Well, most of the wars are the result of the Rothschilds. I mean, let's just be honest. Would there be any wars if there wasn't for international banking? I mean, let's ask ourselves some real questions here. Is it religion, or is it money, or is it something else? I know that they tell us it's religion, and the history books have told us it's religion. And if you go and you reference what you think you know about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's about religion. But it's also about mind control. Because those Palestinian people are raised every second of their life in these camps, basically poking them and prodding them to hate. You know, their textbooks are about hate against a race of people. They are bred to hate, you know. So is that about mind control? And then it becomes, who is funding that mind control? Because would there be a Palestinian conflict if a super monster megalith corporation people weren't completely funding this mind control? Would we have the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? So is this a problem of religion, or is it a problem of this global elite? You know? Because they will tell you it's religion because they have a very, very unique interest in our religious conceptions. And right now, they have a unique interest in wiping Christianity off the map. I'm telling you, people out there, if you are a Christian patriot, you are the world's most dangerous person to these people, especially if you're somebody doing something about it, you know. But that's okay. If you wanted to go do any of these things that I mentioned earlier, know that in that, there is protection. That's really the kicker of all this whole thing. Once you put yourself out there in any way, there's this little time period where you're like, oh my gosh, I'm in danger, you know. They probably want to kill me and everything else. And that time in my life, which was when I first probably started Conspiracy Closing a lot, when I first started doing the show here, and then when I started really actually doing and, you know, talking about things that I really believed and was really starting to be used in this show, is when I really thought, okay, now I'm a little fearful for my life, and if I'm right about any of this stuff, then I'm like probably enemy number one to a lot of people, or in some circles anyway. And if that's true, then I have nothing to defend myself with. There is no defense that I have for myself except for God. And it's like I had this conversation with this pregnant girl at work yesterday, and she's such a sweet girl, and we were talking about, and it turns out she's a Christian when we got to talking. But what was interesting is that in my case, I needed this fear of helplessness and to need God to actually, in essence, run to Him and say, okay, I can't do this on my own. I don't have any way to protect myself. If it's you or nothing, I need you. I need to, what do I need to do to need you? And that became a faith thing and a reliance on God for those provisions. And it took a fear to do that. In her case, pregnancy and not having a father and being scared and being 18 and all this stuff, eventually, after a lot of, she's really pregnant right now, but, you know, after a lot of all the things that, and emotional things that go with being pregnant and everything, it came down to being the one thing that really brought her to the dependence on God that, really is blessing her life. And, you know, it's like one of these things where God's economy is perfect. And I think that there are certain personalities out there, some people that are just so hard-hearted and certain people that are just so selfish and awful, just dark people. But it's not, but God desires their salvation too. You have to remember, he does not will to lose anyone. So for those people, sometimes it requires drastic taking away. I think, and I think in some cases, God gives people terminal diseases. And that could be looked at as, God would give you a terminal disease? That's crazy. But did it take a terminal disease to take some of these people from, to need God? And to save them, ultimately, you know, a lot of people have no understanding because they don't care. They don't even want to spend any amount of time in the day thinking about it, about if there is an afterlife, you know, would I want to be there and so on and whatever. I mean, it's not about the afterlife once you, you know, but let's just say he is doing you a big favor, more than you could ever realize, by taking away something to get you to need him. And that's what it seems to be mostly about, is faith, you know. He just wants you to have faith in him for your life, and he can bless you in it as long as you don't, you've got to continue to just need him and have faith in him and love him. And loving comes through prayer. It comes through just that time spent with him in prayer, and it's just so necessary in our lives. It's just, can't speak any more highly about it. That leads me to my next point here, I guess, and that is that I've been basically living a lot of my life lately in this verse, which is, you know, all things work together for good for those that love the Lord and are called according to His purpose. And I think that it's important to really believe that all things work together for good. Not some things, not kind of some days, but all things work together for good. And if you've ever had a prayer answered in, you know, one of those ways that only God can answer it in, like, the most perfect possible way, and you realize how stupid you were when you thought it wasn't getting answered, and you realize how amazingly it was answered. If you know God like that, and I know a lot of you do, then you'll understand a little bit of what I'm talking about. If you don't understand that yet, then try Him. Pray to God in the name of Jesus Christ. Start to give Him faith and see what He can do with it. It's amazing. It's how this whole thing works. But anyway, let me continue. If you really got that in your mind, that all things work together for good, then it puts a lot of things in perspective, because we know that during the course of the day, the course of your life, things are not going well. A lot of times they do not go well. And so if you look at those things like, well, this is working together for good somehow, I don't understand that, it really helps you stay in prayer for continued provisions during that. Let me give you an example. It's about dealing with all events that happen in the same way, good and bad. It's about every time something is thrown at you, whether it's good or bad, it's about dealing with them in that context, that all things work together for good. Because I'm going to give you an example. Like, lately I've had a lot of issues that I've been really, really needing God for. And I'm talking about life and death things. I've just really needed Him in various areas of my life to show up a lot lately. I mean, it has been crucial. And in those crucial moments, there's this chaos of, will things work out? Will things won't? Oh, here's a monkey wrench in the situation. Here's this problem. And it seems like there are any number of things going on from both sides, I don't know, whatever. It seems like a lot of stuff is going on in the midst of this absolute needing of Him. And there are this times when I could be like, it's like when the bad things happen, I continue to stay focused and prayer for that, and pray for the necessary things in regards to whatever it is that was bad that happened, and not allowing it to just be to ever take me out, you know, and not saying, oh, well, this is too much, there it is, now everything, life is just so hard, this can't happen, everything's going wrong, everything's terrible, you know. And in that moment, it's like a little bit of cursing God, especially in these positions that we're in as Christians, where you need Him. And anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that in those moments, He is answering prayers like crazy. I mean, I have been, as He answers prayers, it's a cycle of praise that I praise Him every minute I can now. I mean, I am praising Him when I get up, when I go to sleep at night, and, you know, driving down the road. I mean, He's answered so many prayers for me lately, and in the most amazing ways, in the most obvious ways, that it's building my faith up, that now I know, I mean, I'm like in the prayer zone right now, you know? And so I've got this faith building up because I've continually trusted in Him and took the leap of faith at first to need Him, you know? Like, there are situations that happen that you probably wouldn't do if you didn't have faith. Like, well, this is obviously not going to work, this can't work, but in those positions, having faith is continues to build it. And it's those bad things that do work together for good in hindsight. Oh, and a lot of times the reason that they work together for good is that they show you, in every situation is different, and I certainly don't want to speak generally here, because God works in amazing ways every time. Every time it's like, wow, that is perfect. How did you think of that? You know? But it does say all things work together for good for those that love the Lord, okay? So all good things work together for you? You might be thinking, well, they don't all work together for me because I don't necessarily love Him and I'm not called according to His purpose, which is the other requirement. Well, I'd beg to differ. I think that you are both of those things, but let's find out how to make sure you are. How to love the Lord is the root of this. And called according to His purpose is pretty simple. You are. I can guarantee you that you're called according to His purpose. And it may not be in some grandiose way, but you're called to according to his purpose. And what is his purpose? Letting your lamp shine, putting your lamp on a lampstand. But let me back up. I know that there is this issue where some people say and have been a Christian their whole life, but kind of, you know, get a little twitchy about the loving God thing. And I was one of them, only just a few short years, months, I don't know. My point is that it hasn't been that long for me and that I've really can say honestly to myself that I love God. I love Jesus. I can't wait to see him. I cannot wait to see them. And in my head, that wasn't easy to say not too long ago. And I guess part of, yeah, and again, I've said this before, but it's the most, you know, it's the most important commandment according to Jesus, you know, who's the founder of Christianity. I mean, that seems to be authoritative enough for me that I need to figure out how to do the most important commandment, which is love God. And the second one is love my neighbor as myself, but it sure comes a lot easier if you love God. And how do you do that? Is the question. I'm not sure if I have the best answer for that, but I will say that a good way to start is it's to understand that you just can't turn it on. I feel it only comes through having him more a part of you, and then it becomes like something, it becomes your nature to love him. As you let him have more of your life, it becomes second nature to love him, because it's because Jesus is love. I mean, let me try to explain it like this. I mean, and how do, I think, let me try to, it's a two-part thing, I guess. First of all, it starts for me, and it started with me in prayer. I think you can pray for stuff like that. You can pray for faith. You can pray for all the things that you need spiritually that you're not, it's not under your power to get. I mean, you just can't do some of these things. Some people condemn themselves for the faith that they don't have. Like, what about that guy in Mark, when he came down from the mountain of the Transfiguration and said, "Lord, help my unbelief." You know, so when Jesus asked him, "Do you believe?" He's like, "Lord, help my unbelief. I believe, but help my unbelief." You know, so I think that it's something that we can ask for. But I guess my point is, as he is more a part of you, and how does that happen? Well, I think, for me anyway, it was a willpower decision. It was, we all have sins. And the reason, like many of the things, the laws that he has given us, isn't the reason that he gives them, I think, is because he knows if we do what he says, a really good thing is there for us. It's always about it's not about, well, I'm going to punish you if you don't do these laws that I arbitrarily made up because I'm God and I can make up any rules that I want. It's not about I'm going to punish you if you don't. It's like, don't do these things because I know what's best for you. And with the taking out sins one at a time, like a sin assassin, just focus and take care of certain ones and start really resisting the devil, and he will flee from you. And that's true in macro sins and micro sins. If you resist the devil in the big ones, like when I quit drinking, I'm telling you, I've drank more than any human being on the planet for 7 years straight. I mean, I was a drunk from the planet drunk. And I was in a bar every night because of the band and everything else. I mean, and I still am, but it's not even an issue anymore. But it was for the first 3 or so months after I quit drinking, because I still had that the devil had not fled from me yet. But it just turned off like a light switch in about 3 months. I didn't care about it anymore. I was convinced I would never have fun anymore. I was convinced I would always eyeball everybody's beers and Jack and Cokes and be mad because I didn't get to drink them. I was convinced that was what my life was going to be like. And then it just left. Once it just miraculously went away. And I think that was the devil fleeing from those that resist him. But it took those 3 months of resisting him. Same thing with cigarettes, although I'd say it took a little longer for it to go away completely. But And then it's true with micro sins. And I think that there, some of them may be considered by you micro. I don't know. But it's the little things. We always got stuff that we can nail. And once we do, then it's like, the blessing is that he gets to be more a part of you and work more freely with you. And that includes being able to bless you more, being able to answer the prayers that you need more. I mean, how many things in this life do we need help with, especially nowadays? I mean, I don't know what my life would be like if I couldn't completely rely on God for everything. I mean, my life has now become a complete and, oh, not quite yet, but almost total reliance on God. And I think that is really good, even though, and it does have a lot to do with really kind of jumping out of this world, but again, as you get more of him in you, then, and again, I always say this, like, more of him, I don't know the mechanics of that, you know, I really don't, but it does seem like, you know, the sin issue is something that prevents a more perfect operation in your body. I mean, just think about if you know, I mean, it's not that a Christian couldn't go out and get just totally drunk and go out and get a hooker or some, you know, sexual immoral sin or something. You know, it's not that a Christian couldn't do that. It's quite possible. It happens all the time, I'm sure. But would that person at that time be able to, you know, where would the Holy Spirit be in that? Would he still be with him? Probably. It doesn't sound like you lose your salvation, and maybe salvation means the Holy Spirit. I don't know. But see what I'm saying? I don't know if the mechanics of where the Holy Spirit, you know, if it's going and what is just more strongly attached. I don't understand that part of it, but I know that there's a connection there that has to do with, you know, sins. And I don't think that we're ever going to be free from sin. That's not what I'm saying. I'm so far from free from sin, it's amazing. But I'm a lot further than I was before I started trying it. It's like exercising the willpower. It's like trying to make that a thing that you try to do. Something that you can like about yourself is, like, one thing that got me to quit drinking was, well, one of the many things was, you know, I wanted to be that kind of person. I want to be like my grandpa, or, you know, or like a general grandpa would be. You know, would like to be the kind of person that if they wanted to do something, they'd do it. You know, they were just a strong old country man, and if they decided something, they were going to do it. I want to be like that. You know, I don't want to be plagued by some fleshy crap, you know, like my whole life just because I'm weak. You know, I want to be a good person. And in that regard, I want to be able to be strong. And I think that and sometimes that can manifest in something exciting, like, if you are tempted by something all day, let's say it's some kind of food, let's say you work in the food industry and you always have some kind of food that's everywhere and it's really impossible not to eat. Well, every time you do that, that can be an exciting thing of practicing resisting that kind of thing. You know, it's not good for a number of reasons to eat it, maybe not a spiritual reason, but let's just start practicing our willpowers. Like, I'm not going to do that. And you're going to walk past it and you're going to turn your willpower on a little bit and just strengthen it. It's like doing a little curl with weights, you know. It's just a little bit, you know, and then pretty soon you'll be able to really resist some serious weight. Okay, let me check my notes, see if I'm missing anything here. Oh, yeah, I want to talk about a few other things here. I don't know if anybody's still listening, but, well, let's just continue if they are. I want to talk about Dr. Deagle. Man, that guy, I can't even believe that I used to sort of, kind of, think that guy was on the up and up. That guy is so clearly, and I think he's even worse than a lot of these guys, he's very seriously a part of this issue. I mean, he himself, this is always something I can't ever consider. I can't ever figure out. This is a guy that says he was offered by the Pindar, who has talked extensively about by Arizona Wilder and, you know, and David Icke, who literally means the phallus of the dragon, who apparently is some kind of major, if not the top-ranking Illuminati guy. This is a genius. Dr. Deagle is a genius no matter how you cut it. He's a really, really smart guy, has a lot of really good information, much like Rants.com, Jordan Maxwell, Michael Tesserian, both of which he calls out specifically as having the truth. And the difference between Deagle is he talks a lot about Yahshua HaMashiach, says it all the time. He doesn't say Mashiach, which is telling, I think, but Yahshua HaMashiach, he talks all the time about him, but yet he in his he's the Gnostic Jesus. It's no more than we are gods. It's a little hard. It's not quite on the surface, but it's exactly the same thing as Jordan Maxwell, Michael Tesserian. The aliens are coming back, and we're going to totally worship them, and it's going to be great, and we're all going to be gods, and we're going to join a world government and a happy day, and let's just shake our pom-poms in the air for global governance and worshiping Nephilim. I mean, this is... It's old school, really. But it's this common theme now that we have these super, super geniuses that are being rolled out, and a lot of people sucking in. The guy's got the show he's on right after Alex Jones. I mean, and he says he says he's one of the two witnesses. He at least says he's one, you know, he's a prophet of God and everything else. He just so happens to deny the divinity of Jesus Christ and, everything else. So that's kind of the one thing that I look for, generally speaking, if I'm going to be prophesied by anyone. So anyway, I want to do something on him specifically, just kind of go through his presentation, not to do an expose. I'm just about sick of exposes, but, and I hope you guys know, I hope those that are listening to me know that I'm not doing that for, any reason, like, I think it's a gimmick, like, oh, that's my thing, I do the exposés, Chris White, the expose guy, I'm the whatever. That's not in any way what I'm trying to do. It's just that I'm seeing this as something that I can't believe people aren't seeing. That's, to me, the crazy part, that I've been in the conspiracy realm for so long, I see these wolves in sheep clothing, and it's so obvious that they're part of this new world order, and everybody believes them. So, you know, it's just a natural progression for me to be like, here, look, this is why these guys are a part of this. Don't you guys see that we're going on a very sure path to global governance by these conspiracy teachers? But they just won't understand the concept. Like, no, man, they are telling us about the Illuminati. How could they be part of the Illuminati? They're telling us about it. That doesn't make any sense. So, you know, it's just frustrating. I guess I probably, let's see what time I'm looking at here. Let me take a little break here, and I need to start doing some more production stuff. Lately, I've just been talking, no intros, no anything, and I was listening back to those old shows, and they used to be really good. I used to, like, take time and make little cool things and funny things, and it was just all real good. I used to take a lot of pride in doing that, and now I've just totally stripped it down to nothing, which I think is beneficial in some ways, but I used to have also trouble filling out an hour, and now I can just, here I'm at, what, an hour and 5 minutes. I haven't even taken a breath yet. Okay, let me take a break, and I'll be right back.
Russ Dizdar explains his ministry, Shatter the Darkness.
Almost 20 years now, we've been just kind of just trying to help people, minister to people, share with people, coming out of cults, you know, just mind control, the occult, left-hand path stuff. And then we ran into the real underground that's been going on for a long time. And so it has a lot to do with deliverance and dealing with the dark side and power encounters and, you know, as confronting perpetrators of violence on children and ritual abuse. It deals with healing the hearts of the victims and, you know, keeping our guard and trying to do what we can to expose it, stop some of it.
You can visit Russ Dizdar's website at shatterthedarkness.net, where you'll find hours of free MP3s and podcasts, as well as courses for your church or your ministry to begin to learn how to deal with encounters of this nature in a biblical way. Shatterthedarkness.net.
Great. I'm the executive director of the Institute for Responsible Technology, and I've written the books Seeds of Deception and Genetic Roulette. We're leading campaigns that we believe can end the genetic engineering of the food supply by informing consumers about the health dangers associated with genetically engineered foods and giving them non-GMO shopping guides so they can make healthier non-GM choices.
And you've got a couple different websites. Tell us about those.
Well, seedsofdeception.com is one of our websites that has products, downloads, free newsletter. And our Institute for Responsible Technology is at responsibletechnology.org. And they link to each other, so if you just remember one, you'll get to the other. And you can sign up for a free monthly e-newsletter, listen to an hour-long talk, watch a sample video. We have the most recent book that I've written is called Genetic Roulette. And I worked with more than 30 scientists over 2 years to document all of the known health risks of genetically engineered foods.
Well, see, I'm an addict of reading, you know, all the scientific papers and even peer-reviewed studies, not just the news articles about them. And listening to you on radio and reading your writings, it's like, oh, I remember that, I remember that, I remember that. And I was shocked at all the stuff I'd forgotten, the incredible admissions they've made, and that as bad as I thought it was even more crazy because you kind of put it all into picture.
When you put it all together and you read it together, you read thousands of sick, sterile, and dead livestock, thousands of toxic and allergic reactions, damage to virtually every organ and every system studied in laboratory animals. And then there's all sorts of assumptions that they used as a basis for safety claims, which turned out to be false. So taken together, we have irrefutable, overwhelming evidence of harm associated with these genetically modified foods.
Well, we're going to break. We're going to come back. Got a long segment coming up. I want you to give us the basic history of it and then go right through how, when they change one gene randomly, and I've had Nobel Prize winners on about this subject who invented this, it randomly changes thousands of others each time there's a new generation of the plant, new amino acids, killing half the mice that were fed it, knowing it's doing it, putting it on the market, genetically engineered pesticides into the food, all the numbers of the milk, the girls at three going into puberty. I mean, this is a holocaust. We cannot, I think, with words, sir, describe just how bad it is.
Well, it is pretty remarkable what a catastrophe our food supply is, and the biggest, most radical change in history is the genetic engineering of the food supply, which came under the radar in 1996, big time.
I agree, and I've interviewed so many experts from so many different fields, and from all of my 13 years of interviewing people on a host of subjects, they believe that genetic engineering is the potentially most dangerous thing we face, more dangerous than thermonuclear weapons. We'll be right back. And there's no controls, folks. It's all open air. It's out there. You're eating it. It's unbelievable. We'll talk to this amazing guest on the other side. Okay, he interviewed scores of scientists for just one of his books alone. I'm telling you, the info he's going to give you is documented. We're very honored to have Jeffrey Smith with us from Institute for Responsible Technology, your consumer safety partner. There is a revolution brewing. When you hear the bad news, remember the good news in the second half of the hour is coming up. Sir, you've got the floor. Lay out what we're facing.
Okay. The FDA should have been pretty heads up about this in the 1980s when a genetically engineered food supplement called L-tryptophan ended up killing about 100 Americans and causing 5,000 to 10,000 to fall sick. Many are still permanently disabled. Only the brand that was genetically engineered to produce this food supplement had these deadly contaminants that caused this epidemic. The only reason the scientists were able to discover it was because the disease was rare, acute, and came on quickly. If all three characteristics had not been in place, that same deadly L-tryptophan might still be on the market. Which begs the question, what about the genetically engineered crops that are on the market? Might they be producing the doubling of food-related illnesses in the United States, or the asthma and allergies, etc.? We don't know because there's no post-marketing surveillance, no human clinical trial. In fact, the FDA had urged their superiors, the scientists, we know this from documents made public from a lawsuit, their scientists had urged their superiors to require long-term safety studies because they said genetically engineered foods could create allergies, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems. But the White House had instructed the FDA to promote the biotechnology industry in 1992, and the person in charge of policy at the FDA was the former attorney of biotech giant Monsanto and later Monsanto's vice president. So the policy ignored the scientists, it ignored the science, and allowed the foods on the market with absolutely no safety tests required. The FDA only has a voluntary consultation process in which the companies basically give summary data and don't actually give raw feeding study data or anything that they can actually evaluate safety. Only one company gave raw feeding study data. It was for a genetically engineered tomato. It turns out that when it was force-fed the tomatoes, because the rats actually refused to eat it, 7 of 40 died within 2 weeks. Another 7 of 20 had stomach lesions. In the UK, they wanted to do long-term safety studies to prove to consumers that GM foods were safe, so they gave a $3 million grant to Dr. Arpad Pusztai, one of the world's leading scientists in his field. He fed supposedly harmless genetically engineered potatoes to rats. It caused potentially precancerous cell growth in the digestive tract, smaller brains, livers, and testicles, partial atrophy of the liver, damaged immune system. And this was because of the process of genetic engineering itself, not the particular change that they made for the potato. He went public with his concerns, was a hero for about 2 days at his prestigious institute, and then two phone calls were allegedly placed from the UK Prime Minister's office, forwarded through the receptionist to the director of the institute. The next morning, Dr. Pusztai was fired from his job after 35 years and silenced with threats of a lawsuit. His 20-member research team was dismantled, and they never implemented the long-term safety testing protocol.
But now he's been vindicated. We've interviewed him several times. Now the studies have come out, and it was right. And he said half the rats that were fed the potato died. I'm going from memory there.
Well, in his case, in his particular study, there were no deaths, but there was another study that was done recently on rats, and these were fed genetically engineered soybeans.
That was the one.
Russian National Academy of Sciences. And they fed it to female adult rats, and it turns out more than half of the offspring died within the first 3 weeks. So the rats themselves that ate it didn't die, but the offspring died. Also, the offspring were on average much smaller, and they couldn't reproduce when they tried to mate them together. This woman who I was in a conference call with yesterday with the Ukraine with a biosafety presentation, she describes how she did this study 3 times in a row with similar results, and then for some reason the rat food that was being bought by the institute and to all of the rats turned out to switch to genetically engineered soy-based rat food. So she couldn't do any more studies, but after 2 months of feeding all of the rats in the facility genetically engineered soy-based rat food, she asked her colleagues, what's the infant mortality? It had shot up to over 55%, suggesting that it wasn't just her particular batch of GM soy that caused the problem, but it's generic. In fact, when they fed GM soy to mice, they looked at the testicles and they found that there was changes in the young sperm cell. They looked at the embryos when the parent mice were fed GM soy, and the embryo DNA acted differently.
Good God.
When this Russian scientist fed male rats GM soy, the testicles turned dark blue instead of pink, and the whole cell structure looked different.
I got to stop you for a minute, and we've interviewed that scientist you mentioned and many others. The point here is this stuff's been approved, humans are eating this, and lo and behold, we see fertility plummeting, we see all the same things. God, I can't believe that this is happening, and I can't believe these companies have done this.
It's remarkable. You know, when you look at their goals, Arthur Andersen Consulting worked with Monsanto early on, and they bragged in 1999 in January conference about how they worked with Monsanto executives. They asked the executives to describe their ideal future in 15 to 20 years, and the Monsanto executives described a world in which 100% of all commercial seeds were genetically engineered and patented. And Andersen Consulting worked backwards from that goal to create the strategy and tactics to achieve it. So they have very large goals, the takeover of the food supply on Earth.
Now we do specifically from the scientists in the studies know what it does, because every time they change one gene to make a potato last longer or taste better or whatever the case may be, by adding insectoid genetics or mammal or other plant genetics, then it's, and I'd like you to elaborate on this, it then is a, like you say, genetic roulette. Randomly thousands of things each generation change, and can you get into that?
Sure. We'll come back to some of the other health risks about the thousands of dead animals.
Well, I mean, do that now if you want. Go ahead.
Either way, actually, let's alter them. I think your question is excellent. The process of genetic engineering, people think it's just splicing it in precisely. What they do is they take a gene that produces its own pesticide out of soil bacteria. They take that gene, make millions of copies, make some changes in it, add a promoter from a virus to turn it on 24/7 around the clock, and then they put it into a gene gun. They actually shoot the gun into millions of cells, hoping that some of the genes make it into the DNA of some of the cell. And then only a few of them actually get the genes, which they then grow that cell into a plant using cloning or tissue culture. Now, the process of inserting the gene and the process of cloning the cell into a plant both create massive collateral damage in the DNA. We're talking 2 to 4% difference of the DNA after it's been genetically engineered compared to before it started. So we're talking any particular mutation, any single point mutation could have deadly consequences. We're talking about hundreds or thousands.
And one food plant might have 50, 60 different chimeras where they're already splicing other organisms and then splicing that and then sticking viruses on top and then firing it in randomly. Good, we're probably already doomed.
Well, it turns out soon after GM soy was introduced to the UK, soy allergies skyrocketed by 50%. No follow-up studies were done. So when you look at all of the studies together and say, well, how could a genetically engineered soybean increase allergies? It turns out there are many candidates. This process of disrupting the DNA caused an increase of a known allergen in soybeans, up to 7 times higher in cooked soy, according to Monsanto's own study. They also did a skin prick test with individuals, and at least one person had a reaction only to the genetically modified soy and not to natural soy. They then looked into the soybean and found that there was a completely new and unexpected protein, also likely from this result of massive collateral damage, and that new protein was allergenic.
And then, by the way, we see studies all the time where they're growing this stuff open air, and it's now jumping into other plants. So
don't get me started on that. That's the worst problem. We're taking self-generating, self-propagating genetic pollution and putting it into the environment where we have no technology to recall it.
And never before vandalizing the very genetic code of the biosphere because these are systems that never occurred over millions of years of natural development. Now it's just randomly invading. Good God.
Beautifully said. And not only that, but the genes we introduced today may outlast the effects of nuclear waste. I mean, they are self-propagating possibly for the rest of our biosphere's life.
And already replicating and merging and already causing, I mean, this is insane.
Just to finish up with the allergies, because I know there's a lot of allergy sufferers listening, and they may want to know if these things are safe or not.
Well, that's why it's growing.
Yes. And I talked to one allergist, by the way. He said, I used to do soy tests for soy allergies all the time, but now that it's genetically engineered, it's so dangerous, I tell my patients never to even try it unless it's organic and non-GMO.
God.
So there's another thing is that the reason why 80% of all genetically engineered foods are created, and there's only 4 major crops, soy, corn, cotton, and canola, and all 4 have been engineered not to die when sprayed with the company's herbicide. So if you spray a natural soy plant with Roundup herbicide, you'll kill it. But if you spray genetically engineered Roundup Ready soy or cotton or canola or corn, then it will not die. It just all the rest of the biodiversity and weeds and plants in the field will die. Now, that means that we pour lots more herbicide on these crops, and then when you ingest them, you ingest higher levels of this herbicide, which also might cause reactions. In addition, mice that were fed genetically engineered soy had problems with their livers, suggesting that there was a toxic insult, and their pancreas cells had changes which reduced the amount of enzymes needed to digest food.
And we now similarly see all sorts of previously rare cancers skyrocketing, juvenile onset of all these cancers mimicking what we see in the lab animals.
And any one of which could easily be from genetically engineered foods because it's totally a genetic roulette. One of the things is when you insert this gene cassette, which they blast into the crop, you have what's called a promoter, an on switch, which can not only just turn on this foreign gene, but it might switch on any other gene in the DNA permanently,
and that's why
it's overproduced.
And that's why it's affecting embryos in mammals.
Well, I mean, we don't actually know why it's affected. We know it has affected it, but the problem is there's not enough studies to identify the causation.
Good God, this, and when we get back, they're now expanding it out into every crop you can imagine. It's just, I have children, folks. You have children. We've got to stop this. Stay there. It just gets more out of control when we get back with our guest. Stay with us. Bert Nixon lied to us all on TV.
for the Beatles.
We're back live, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, I should have mentioned our guest has the best-selling book worldwide on genetically engineered foods. This is stuff that I've ordered, I'm getting, and I'm going to read it all. I try to keep my children off this. I try to stay away from myself, but it's so hard. We have to. That will force the change in the industries, but they're striking back, and so our guests can tell us about that. Tell us about your best-selling book and how folks get that.
Well, Seeds of Deception is the book. It's at seedsofdeception.com. And it's sort of, I decided to weave the science of genetic engineering into the stories of how scientists were fired, stripped of responsibilities, forced out, how regulatory agencies were hijacked by the biotech industry, offered bribes, stocked with people with the biotech company's own personnel, how they rigged research, how Fox TV reporters were threatened by Monsanto's attorney, promising dire consequences to Fox and Rupert Murdoch if they ran a five-part news series on the bovine growth hormone, how a senior professor from UC Berkeley was threatened by a Mexican official who allegedly said, "We know where your children go to school," trying to get him to not publish incriminating evidence. So I dug out the hard, the dark underbelly of GMOs and turned them into a series of stories, and then I weave the science into those stories so people can understand the risks that these foods present.
Now GMOs are obviously the most dangerous, but just going back to with what Searle did with when they had good old Rumsfeld, who was later at Monsanto running it, and almost all, and I've read the study on air, almost all the monkeys they gave aspartame to, the baby monkeys died, and they still approved it. I mean, it's like, and so out of that culture grows this.
In fact, the aspartame is the product of genetically engineered microorganisms, so it is in the category that I report on.
Well, let's try to spend some time on that. I'm sad we only have an hour with you today. Please continue with the health effects you were getting into.
Okay. There's at least two more major categories I want to discuss. One is there's two traits that are genetically engineered. We already talked about herbicide tolerance, the ability to spray a genetically engineered crop with herbicide and not kill it. The other is there's about 20% of the crops are engineered to produce their own insecticide in every cell and in every bite. It's called BT, for Bacillus thuringiensis. It's used in organic agriculture in its natural form as a bacteria, but it's not necessarily safe. In fact, if you ask the biotech industry and the Food and Drug Administration and the EPA about BT toxin, they say, "Oh, no, don't worry about it. It has a history of safe use. It's used in organic agriculture." Well, they ignore the fact that about 500 Americans and Canadians had allergic reactions when it was used for spraying gypsy moth infestation. They ignore the fact that when BT toxin was fed to mice, the mice had damaged intestines and an immune response as powerful as cholera toxin.
But plus it's been genetically altered and put inside, not a little bit of fungus on the outside.
Exactly. So, and it's designed to be in concentrations thousands of times greater than in the spray form. It's designed to be more toxic than the spray form. It has properties of a known allergen. And so they just put it in the food supply and assume it's safe and don't do any testing on human beings to find out if it's safe.
Now I want to be clear. Allergen, we've been desensitized to that term, like, oh, it's an allergy. An allergy is when your body is fighting against something, saying, "This is hurting me."
And that's what's happening now with Indian farm workers who are picking genetically engineered cotton engineered to produce this BT toxin. Just by touching the cotton, by loading it onto trucks, by leaning against it, they're developing allergic reactions, some having to go to the hospital. And the allergic symptoms are exactly the same as those of the 500 Americans and Canadians who complained of allergic reactions when they were sprayed with the BT in its natural form. Then in India, they allow sheep to graze on the cotton plants after harvest, and within a week of grazing, one out of every four sheep are dead. An estimated 10,000 sheep died in the region. Now you also have the fact that genetic engineering causes unpredicted side effects in the growing, and so they convinced thousands and thousands of cotton farmers to plant Monsanto's genetically engineered cotton. The cotton failed in many parts, and tens of thousands have committed suicide as a result of being indebted and not being able to pay back their loans. In fact, the BT corn, the corn engineered to produce this toxin, has been associated by farmers with thousands of sterile pigs, hundreds of sterile cows.
Well, most of the farmers I talk to say their animals won't even eat it unless you mix it in with some sugar. Stay there. Yeah, the bugs and animals won't eat it, but we are. Folks, just like you said earlier, the rats won't eat these tomatoes. You have to force feed them.
We're on the march. The empire's on the run. Alex Jones and the GCN Radio Network.
This is good, like a few others, and they really help these children. The IMF, the World Bank, they're not there to help them. They're there to force GMO on them and the rest of it. But Children International is there to help them, and I'd like my listeners to join me. I'm a sponsor to Children. In fact, I'm doing it today when I get off air, and I'll tell you about them Monday, who I've sponsored. But I'd like you to at least sponsor one child. $22 a month, as tough as it is financially here in the U.S., it's a lot tougher in the third world. Instead of giving your money to these big, fat, warmongering neocon preachers that are all over television, you need to tithe in this type of way, especially Christians out there. And if you're not giving back, I give to Meals on Wheels. I give to Salvation Army. I know those are two good groups. You need to give to Children's International, ladies and gentlemen. You need to give directly to the children. You'll get, you know, they'll write you letters. You'll write them letters, photos, progress, and to watch them grow up. Even if you do it for a year, that's great, but I do it for 5, 10 years. I'm going to do a 10-year commitment with the children that I help. So, again, go to Infowars.com and link through right there and sponsor these children. Okay, going back to our guest, best-selling author Jeffrey M. Smith, Seeds of Deception, now Genetic Roulette. Please continue, sir.
Well, you made a very good point about some of the people you talk to describe how animals will not eat genetically engineered feed when given the choice. We've seen that with geese, cows, pigs, elk, deer, raccoons, squirrels, mice, and rats. So it's my job to get people up to the level of animals. And I teach people how to avoid it. It's on my website at seedsofdeception.com. One of the most shocking results that really motivate people to avoid eating genetically engineered foods came in the only human feeding experiment ever conducted on GMOs. Now, this was to determine whether or not genes survive digestion, because this was a big concern among the FDA. In fact, the British Medical Association, which called for a moratorium on GMOs, linked this as one of the reasons. They were concerned that genes from genetically engineered plants might transfer into the DNA of human gut bacteria. Now, what they were concerned about was the antibiotic-resistant marker gene that's used in GM crops that could end up creating bacterial diseases that are accidentally engineered to withstand medicines, to withstand antibiotics. And so the biotech industry told the FDA, oh, don't worry, genes are destroyed during digestion. Transfer into the DNA of human gut bacteria is not possible. So they took seven, after years and years, late in 2002, they finally did a test. They took seven human volunteers, and these volunteers had colostomy bags. They had their lower intestines removed, not for the study. And they fed them genetically engineered soy burgers and soy milkshakes, and they found, to their surprise, how much intact genetically engineered soy had survived digestion through the stomach and small intestine and ended up in the colostomy bag.
Well, look at the Crohn's type diseases are exploding. Everybody I know seems to have intestinal problems. And then the universities in Germany found what's killing the honeybees predominantly is that this bacteria that is been genetically engineered in these crops is getting into the honeybees and frying their little gut.
Well, you're getting ahead of me, because that's exactly what they found. The next thing that they checked, they looked inside the bacteria before they fed these people the burger and milkshake, and they found that in three of the seven human volunteers, the gene that had been inserted into the soybean to make the soybean resist death by herbicide, that herbicide-tolerant gene had transferred from some soy food they had eaten in the past and had taken up residence in the DNA of their gut bacteria and continued to function, which means long after they stop eating genetically engineered soybeans, they're still producing this foreign genetically engineered protein inside their own intestines.
Now, a corollary to this, and I keep interrupting, I want listeners to know, you're only giving them the base stuff. As scary as it sounds, it gets much worse. in over 90%, these are federal studies, but they haven't gotten a lot of attention, of people with Crohn's disease and also in autistic children, they are finding the measles virus from the vaccine in their gut. So, again, you take something that's been genetically modified in a vaccine, and it's frying the guts. I mean, this is incredible.
Yes, and the thing is, the gut bacteria is very important. In fact, there are 10 times more cells in our gut bacteria than there are in our entire body. The gut bacteria is used for creating vitamins and minerals. It's used as part of the immune system, and it's used as part of digestion. Now, consider what would happen if you eat a genetically engineered corn chip. Now, corn is genetically engineered predominantly to produce a pesticide. If the gene that produces this pesticide were to transfer to the DNA of your gut bacteria, it might theoretically transform your intestinal flora into living pesticide factories, possibly for the long term. So this is a completely possible scenario.
But you say possible, they're covering it up. This stuff's happening everywhere.
Now, when I talk about this at medical conferences, and I've been to several, the doctors come up to me afterwards, and what they say consistently is, you know, we've seen a lot of gastrointestinal problems in the last 10 years. Maybe it's this colonization of the gut bacteria from genes that have been inserted into crops. Now, the biotech industry, when I've debated them, they'll come back with a really wimpy argument saying, oh, well, if genes transferred from plants, we'd be green, we'd have the photosynthesis. If genes transferred from plants, it would happen all the time. But they completely neglect the fact that there are natural barriers from genes transferring from plant genes into bacteria DNA. But with genetically engineered crops, they put in genes from bacteria into the plant.
Which is animal, which is able to transfer over and is.
Exactly. It is optimized. In all of the natural barriers that we know about that prevent transfer from plant genes into bacteria are overcome and stripped away
since you bring up their spin. This is the Rush Limbaugh talking point. They say George Washington Carver crossed plants and got different varieties. Well, that was using natural breeding, like breeding dogs or horses. You weren't changing any of the original DNA. You were taking the animal with different characteristics and going for that, and you still get some problems. That's totally different. They talk to us like we're little kids. No, if you take a bacteria and stick a cockroach gene and a plant gene in it, and maybe 15 other genes, and then stick it in a corn plant, that's totally separate.
That's very well said, and that is exactly their spin. They try and say, oh, we've been doing this for 10,000 years, it's just a more precise method. It's needed to feed a hungry world, and it's safe, and the FDA proves it's safe, and it'll reduce pesticides, and it'll increase yields. All of that is PR spin. Now, about this time, I'm suspecting that some of your listeners are concerned about how to avoid eating genetically engineered food. So I think we have to touch on that before we get into more of these risks. There are four ways. First, you can buy products that say organic. Second, an organic product should not allow to use GM input. Second, you can buy products which have voluntary labels on it that say non-GMO or made without genetically modified ingredients. Third, you can consult a shopping guide, which you can find on our website at seedsofdeception.com under how to avoid GM foods. And fourth, you can learn what the at-risk ingredients are and read the panels on the side of the packages to make sure it doesn't contain one of the 7 genetically engineered crops in North America. And that is soy, corn, cotton, and canola. Those are the 4 major ones. And unfortunately, soy and corn are in, I would say, 9 out of 10 processed foods. In all sorts of derivatives. You can get a list of those derivatives on our site.
Because they're the big cheap filler.
Yeah, exactly.
Now let me stop you. Seedsofdeception.com, everyone, you've got to take control of your life now. You've got to go check this out. You've got to at least start trying to discover how to eat organic. Now, I want to expand on this, though, because the feds have tried to come in now because we forced a lot of stores to start adopting organic or at least non-GMO, you know, which means it's not organic practices to give you the plant. It's still pesticides and things for listeners that don't know, but at least it's not a chimera. It hasn't had genes shot into it, so it's at least a little bit. I mean, pesticides a lot better than, you know, some little bacteria that's been GMO'd. But now they're coming in trying to, as you know, I mean, I'm telling the listeners this, trying to change it where they can certify something something organic. If it's 75% altered, they're trying to not let milk companies and cheese and yogurt from the products say we don't have these dangerous hormones that have been synthetically made that are making three-year-old girls in mass go into puberty now. I mean, all of this is happening. And, of course, that's the good news. We're waking up, taking action, so they're fighting back. And then the even bigger threat on top of that, you know, after you explained to us how they're trying to block us and how we can fight back, is that if we don't stop them now, we only have, you know, a few dozen things that they've planted worldwide on a mass scale that we're now eating. As he said, the seven major food crops. The problem is they've got thousands of labs integrating into, you know, trees that produce oils, essential oils, into grasses, into everything. You say, well, I don't eat grass. You're going to breathe that. And grasses and things are designed to spread. They will get outside the fields. I mean, I know I'm shotgunning myself here, but that's what goes on in my mind.
Yes, in fact, the pollen issue is a problem. In the Philippines, they found that a certain variety of genetically modified corn that produced its own toxin apparently was responsible for skin, respiratory, and intestinal reactions and fever in five different villages that planted this genetically engineered variety.
It's the BT killing the bees. Yeah, but go ahead.
Yeah, and it's also, that's a possibility, although I wouldn't say it would be the primary cause because there's some bee deaths in countries where there's very little acreage, but it could be a contributory factor, and yes, the genes do transfer to gut microorganisms inside the bee, and yes, but when they take the pollen from these pesticide-producing corn plants, their immune system is compromised.
Yes.
So getting to some more information about how to avoid eating genetically engineered food, this also relates to that milk issue that you talked about.
Yeah, let's talk about
that. There is a genetically engineered drug called recombinant bovine growth hormone, RBGH, or it's also called RBST, and it's from Monsanto. And this will take a long time to discuss all the details, but essentially they inject it into dairy cows to increase milk supply. The biggest health concern is that the milk has higher levels of a hormone called IGF-1, and that is very deeply linked to cancer and an increased rate of fraternal twins. And right now, because the person in charge of policy at the FDA, when that was approved, was Monsanto's former attorney, they don't require labeling of dairy products when the cows are injected. In fact, if a company wants to label their product as made without the use of this drug, that Monsanto has sued companies to say that it's illegal. Now they're trying to get states like Pennsylvania, Kansas, Utah, Indiana, Missouri to make it illegal for dairies to label their products as free from the use of this hormone.
In a supposed free society, they're suing and blocking. And I remember 4 or 5 years ago, you'd see it on the milk. Suddenly, that's off the milk.
Well, what's happening is, in the last 2 years, there's been so much consumer education toward the tipping point to drive this off the market that about 40 out of the top 100 dairies have committed to stop using RBGH in some or all of their products. And that includes Starbucks, who took it out of their company brands by the end of last year, Kroger's that took it out by this
month. And this is the good news, is that and you and others, all of us together, we're having a victory.
It's fantastic. In fact, you know, the tipping point concept is very real. In 1999, in January, a biotech company was projecting a 95% takeover of all commercial seeds within 5 years. But within a month, their ideal future crashed because a food scandal erupted about GMOs and GM food safety in Europe. Within 2 months after that high-profile event, in a single week, virtually every major food company in Europe committed to remove GM ingredients from their European brands because it had become a liability because consumers were taking steps to protect themselves. My organization, the Institute for Responsible Technology, has a plan in place to achieve that same type of tipping point in the U.S. before the end of 2009, simply by informing consumers about the type of health dangers we've talked about today, plus many more, and putting in their hands a non-GMO shopping guide so that they will shift their purchases to those wise companies that don't use GMOs, making it a marketing liability for those that do.
And let's be clear, this is literally life and death. The biosphere is this is the real environmental crisis. Not plastic bags, not the greenhouse. That's all because they want a global tax in their own documents. Meanwhile, we're rushing towards oblivion, and they're, this revolution of wild, open, reckless genetic engineering is just exploding. Can you briefly speak to, we've got to stop them and slow them now?
Absolutely. There's 172 different species that have been field trialed in the United States alone. That means that they have a version of a genetically engineered food of to replace virtually all the natural food on the shelves and in the gardens and in the fields. Now, they're trying to introduce the next major crop in the United States for the first time in over a decade, genetically engineered sugar beets. The sugar beet industry wants to plant them starting this year, which will contaminate the sugar in the United States and around the world by the end of this year. So we are in a very pitched battle right now to stop the introduction of GMOs and to demonstrate to the food industry that GMOs in general are going to be a very rapidly a liability for selling.
And you haven't even gotten into how, what, 90-something percent of the ancient Mexican corn crops have been infected with just one Monsanto variety. You haven't even gotten into how these GMO crops are taking over the original crops.
Yes, that's some of the real bad news.
Yeah, we're going to have you back up for 2 hours in the next few weeks. This is unbelievable. Final segment with our guests. We've got listeners wanting to know about the Doomsday Vault that the elites have built. You know, this is all so wonderful. Why have they done this? With our amazing guest, his new book is Genetic Roulette.
Get up, stand up.
Folks, I want you to know something.
Stand up for
this is not my opinion. I probably had 50 genetic engineers and scientists on this show. We're going to have more and more on. And the gentleman you're listening to, he's giving you what's documented, you know, what he can conservatively say. It's even worse. I have children, and I'm telling you, they have no future. Yours have no future if we don't turn this around. And I want you to get his books. I want you to get his videos. They got some very good packages at their website. And I want you to have showings at your library, everywhere. We got to get mad and tell all the environmentalists who've been caught by the corporates. See, the corporates know there's people are waking up, so they give you little, you know, light bulbs and bags and banned bottles. Dioxin's bad, folks. It's nothing compared to this. This is the big issue. Would you say, because I really see you as the preeminent expert, Jeffrey M. Smith, would you agree with the statement I just made?
Well, absolutely. I'd say genetically engineered organisms are one of the most dangerous health and environmental threats faced by humanity. I would also say it's one of the easiest of the major problems to fix in terms of the food supply.
But how do we deal with these psycho companies? What's wrong? I mean, I know Monsanto in 99, it was in major magazines like National Geographic. Remember when they came out and said, our plan is to contaminate everything so you won't have a choice? I'm paraphrasing the quote.
Yes, indeed. In fact, a friend of mine was debating with someone from USAID in South Africa, and when the TV cameras went down, they continued to argue, and at one point she said, you just wait. We'll have so much genetically modified corn in South Africa that no one in Africa can plant non-GM corn. It was contamination by design.
Good God. We've got to have you back up soon. I've got Daniel Esslin from Spain joining us, but can you stay? We're about to break just another five-minute segment, 5 minutes into the next hour, or do you have to go?
Sure, I can do that.
Okay, good, because I want to plug the book again. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if we don't cause a massive awakening now, this is going to get firmly entrenched, spread throughout the biosphere, spreading into other plants already. In fact, it always does. The mindset of these companies, though, how are the people that work at them so evil? Don't they care about their own families?
Well, you know, I interviewed someone from Monsanto who had left the company, and he was recruited in 97. And he actually evaluated the words of the then CEO, Robert Shapiro, who promised great things for the world from genetic engineering. It impressed the heck out of this guy. And so during the employee orientation in Monsanto's headquarters, he waxed philosophical about what he was doing for the world. He got pulled over after the meeting by a vice president and said, wait a minute, what the CEO, Robert Shapiro, says is one thing. What we do is something else. We're here to make money. We don't even know what he's talking about.
It's incredible. Yeah, well, we're going to feed the Africans, but the Africans are smart enough to let this stuff rot on the dock.
Yeah, when I spoke to the House of Chiefs in Zambia, I apologized on behalf of the United States, which tried to bully them to take genetically engineered food aid, and I applauded them for resisting it, because of course feeding 80% or 90% of the caloric intake as genetically engineered corn to people that are already immuno-suffering and malnourished would be a disaster.
You know, in a sick way, though, by you and others stopping them from poisoning people en masse, it actually, in a sick way, lets them continue. If you just let it go into Africa and then it killed a bunch of people, we might be able to stop it. I'm not saying do that, but, I mean, do you see the point I'm making?
I am, but we started the segment, the show talking about how L-tryptophan had killed 100 Americans and caused 5,000 to 10,000 to fall sick, and how difficult it was to even trace it to the L-tryptophan. If we saw lots of people dying, they could easily let it go and not attribute it to genetically engineered food.
Well, they're already doing that because they don't teach the doctors through the American Medical Association how to diagnose unless, like you said, it's incredibly acute.
Exactly. Acute and fast-acting and rare symptoms. Otherwise, if it's cancer or heart disease, who would know? They wouldn't say, have you been
eating? We'll be back with a final segment with you, my friend, in just 60 seconds. By the way,
Monsanto is backed against the corner because the tipping point is occurring against genetically engineered bovine growth hormone. And so starting in October in Pennsylvania, the Department of Agriculture, the Secretary of Ag, passed a ruling saying it was illegal for companies to label their products as RBGH-free, or as they say, RBST-free. And there was such an outcry that the governor's office stopped the ruling and said, we're going to delay it by a month to review. And he finally came out with a compromise plan that allowed for the labeling but required this bogus sentence saying that according to the FDA, there's no difference in milk from cows treated with RBGH or not. And that bogus sentence was written by Monsanto's former attorney who was in charge of policy at the FDA, and it's a lie. There's a significant difference between the milk from cows treated with RBGH. It has higher levels of IGF-1, which is linked to cancer, and I mean very linked to cancer. Women with high levels of IGF-1 who are premenopausal are 7 times more likely to develop breast cancer. Men are 4 times more likely to develop prostate cancer, and it's in much higher levels in milk from cows treated with RBGH. So, unfortunately, we have sort of won in Pennsylvania. We've sort of won in Utah, but it's being fought now. I mean, in Ohio.
So who do we lobby? Who do we lobby?
We're lobbying right now Kansas, Missouri, and Utah are the main ones right now.
Okay, so in closing, because the listeners will get mad, I forgot this question. The Doomsday Vault that they've built 1,000 kilometers from the North Pole filled with all of the seed stock that hasn't been contaminated.
Well, certainly these type of vaults are all over the planet, and they're not often well kept up. And sometimes a biotech company will sort of take an ownership interest in them so that they can have access to the germplasm to genetically engineer it, patent it, and then further their plans to control the world's food supply. I happen to know Cary Fowler, who is the director of the Norwegian plant. He's a very good man, and he has a very good dream for protecting the world's seed supply for the long term. Now, whether or not the corporate interests are involved in it and what their level of interest is and what their level of ability to manipulate that, it's hard to say. But this is something that's of fundamental importance to protect the biodiversity. When the Green Revolution was started in India, they had 250,000 varieties of rice. They knocked it down to a few hundred.
And by the way, I've got to stop you again. I've got to stop you again because we're almost out of time here. You just brought up all other things. The big GMO companies are buying up all the heirloom seeds, so you can't get them.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Monsanto is the largest seed company in the world. Uh-huh. And so they're reducing the amount of non-GM seeds available in certain seed categories. So they're really in a situation to control the shots if they own the seed supply.
Seedsofdeception.com. Seeds of Deception is the best-selling book. The brand-new book is Genetic Roulette. We're going to have you back up for a two-hour interview when you get back after the 16th from that conference. All I can say is, Jeffrey M. Smith, God bless you for what you're doing for all of humanity. People need to support you, and thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Ellie.
An amazing individual. There he goes. We'll be back with Daniel Estulin from Spain, and then a lot more, ladies and gentlemen. We're living in very interesting times.
Rare Earths and Forbidden Cures, a book written by Joel Wallach. Joel Wallach is the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. Dead Doctors Don't Lie. A very humorous tape that I heard some years back in which he made a remarkable statement. He said, "The average longevity of medical doctors in the United States is 57 years old." Now think about that. The average lifespan in the United States of Joe Sixpack driving truck and Sally housewife taking her kids to the soccer practice is 75.5 years. 75 and a half years. Medical doctors, the boys that give us all of these drugs and cures and all of this medical research, die on average at age 57. Hey, there's got to be something wrong. When I heard that statement, I said, well, my God, medical doctors should live to be 85 or 90 if the rest of us live to be 75, because these guys are the professionals. These are the guys that tell us how to live longer, healthier, happier, more wholesome lives. Isn't that why we go to the doctor? When we get sick, you don't go down to Flo's Whorehouse or down to O'Leary's Bar. You go to the doctor. You go to the clinic. You go to the hospital. Don't you? And that's because we believe, or at least I thought we believed, that when you get sick, you go to the doctor because the doctor's got the cure. Well, if the doctor's got the cure, then how come the doctors die 18 years earlier than the rest of us? That doesn't make any sense, does it? Well, Dr. Wallach didn't think it made any sense either. And so he did a little research and found out that doctors rely upon drugs rather than foods for their healing art. And Dr. Wallach, being a veterinarian, made an observation. He said, you know, we can't treat cows like we treat people because it's not economical. He likened it to a story in which he said, let's suppose that a cow had diabetes. Well, could we afford then to give this cow a shot of insulin two or three times a day in order to keep her alive and producing in the milk herd? No, he said, that wouldn't be economical. If a cow had plugged up arteries, could we give the cow coronary bypass surgery? No, he said, that wouldn't be economical. So the way veterinarians deal with disease in cattle is to determine, what nutritional deficiency is this cow suffering from? And so, as an example, he said, well, when a cow has got this kind of a disease, we determine that it's suffering from some mineral deficiency. And so we give them a mineral block. And sure enough, the cow goes out and licks on the mineral block. And she gets the minerals that she needs. And then the disease goes away. You know, it's kind of like scurvy. You know, if somebody comes up with scurvy, then we give them vitamin C and the scurvy goes away, because scurvy is a deficiency disease. And when we look into disease, we find that disease comes in two forms. One, it's a deficiency of something that you need, like vitamin C causes scurvy. Or two, it's a toxic disease, which means that you're suffering from some kind of a poison which is causing this malady. For instance, we see on the news, they give us the report on the pollen count. Every night the weatherman says, oh, the pollen count is thus and such, and here's how much pollen is in the air, so many parts per million or billion or something. And what's happening here is that you're ingesting so many bits and pieces and parts of these pollens, and these pollens then are irritants, and they cause your eyes to water and your nose to run, and you feel real bad. And so you go to the doctor to get some kind of a remedy to prevent or to stop or to alleviate these symptoms. But is the doctor really the guy that you need to go to? Because if the doctor's dying at age 57, doesn't that tell you that, well, maybe he doesn't know as much as we thought he did? So disease then is either a deficiency or a toxin, or it's a combination of the two. You know, you could take too much arsenic and the net result would be death. Or you could take this arsenic and then you could follow the arsenic with an antidote, which might be activated charcoal, which would then neutralize the poison, which then would equal life. So we look upon the medical doctor as the guy that's got the right chemical balance. We got a chemical imbalance, and the doctor is going to give us the right chemical balance. And so when you go to the doctor and he promotes some kind of a drug to you, you know, maybe it's Vioxx. Does that mean that you're suffering from a Vioxx deficiency, and so he gives you Vioxx? I mean, if you had scurvy, he would say, well, you've got a vitamin C deficiency, so we need to eat more oranges or more green peppers or something that's got vitamin C, or maybe we'll just give you a supplement here. Let's just give you a vitamin C pill. And that would solve that problem. So when the doctor is recommending to you that you take a Nasonade or Vioxx or some other drug, is he saying to you that you're suffering from a Vioxx deficiency? Well, it would appear to me that that's exactly what he's telling you. Now, where does this Vioxx come from? Isn't it an inorganic chemical compound discovered by some pharmaceutical company over here, promoted and sold over the counter to alter the chemical balance in your body? But let me ask you this. Is there something wrong with the chemical balances in our bodies, particularly here in the United States, where we have so much in the way of disease? Now, if the average guy dies at age 75 and a half, doctors die at age 57, what about the rest of us? Well, I took a look at some obituaries here in the book. This is a great big thick book. Let me see how many pages are in here. We're at about 500 pages. 500 pages. It's called Rare Earths and Forbidden Cures. The author is Joel D. Wallach and Ma Lan. And between the two of them, they've got a BS, a DVN, and an ND, an MD, and an MS. I don't know what the MS is. But Ma Lan is his wife, and they wrote this book, and it's a big, thick manual, and it deals with these trace elements, of which he says there are 90 of these trace elements that you have to have if you want to live to be old and full of years. And this book is printed and published by the Double Happiness Publishing Company, P.O. Box 1222, Bonita, California, 91908. I'll give you that again. It's printed and published by the Double Happiness Publishing Company. I imagine if you wrote them a letter, I imagine they'd probably tell you what the price is. I haven't got a clue as to how much it is. P.O. Box 1222, Bonita, California, 91908. But I can give you a little more information. They got a telephone number here somewhere. And I suppose if you called 1-800-755-4656, you might get an answer. Again, that's 1-800-755-4656. And while you're at it, make sure you ask for the audio tape called Dead Doctors Don't Lie. He's got a price on that one. It's $30. I think that's it. Dead Doctors Don't Lie. Forget calorie counting, cholesterol, exercise, and too much salt. Dr. Wallach shatters the health myths. His humor combined with irresistible simple logic provides hope and inspiration for those whose health problems are out of control. The concepts taught by Dr. Wallach empower you like never before to take control of your own health. The classic 2-hour and 16-minute lecture, $29.95. Dead Doctors Don't Lie. Now, he's standing, here's a picture of him in here, he's standing next to a gravestone here. It says, died. The average age of medical doctors in 1895, 54.6 years. In 1993, 57.6 years. Journal of the American Medical Association. Came from JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association. Well, in 1895, they died about age 55, and in 1993, 100 years later, they're dying at age 57 or 58. Now, Wallach was a veterinarian, and I kind of like this solution to the problem that he described with cattle. He said, you know, if you got a cow over here that's got a mineral deficiency, we put a salt lick out here that has mineral by mineral blocks. I can relate to that because that's what I do. I go over to the feed store and I buy, you know, five or six mineral blocks and I stick them out in the various fields, you know, so that all the cattle, all the sheep, you know, have access to this mineral block. And if they're not getting enough minerals out of the food that they're eating, they go over and they lick on that block and they'll get the minerals that they need. Trace elements, 90 of them. Well, Dr. Wallach said the solution for humans is just as simple. What you do is you go down to the feed store and you get a salt lick and you put it on the dining room table. And every time you walk by the dining room table, you just lean over and you lick on it a couple, three licks and then go about your daily routine. Every time you come back through the dining room, you stop and lick on it two or three licks and that'll take care of your mineral problems and probably take care of your diabetes and rheumatism and arthritis and everything else, because you'll notice that cattle have better health than people. Cattle have better health than people. Well, at least they do here in the United States. Well, I thought I'd take a look at a couple of three obituaries here. So over here on page 323, there's a couple of three obituaries, and I thought I'd share that with you because the first one here, Stuart Cartwright, age 38, family practice physician. Young fellow, 38 years old, Stuart Cartwright, 38, a family practice physician, formerly with Kaiser Permanente in La Mesa, died suddenly Wednesday at his home. Dr. Cartwright practiced at the La Mesa Kaiser Permanente outpatient clinic for the past 2.5 years and was in the process of joining a local medical group. He died of cardiac aneurysm, his family said. Doctor died. Cardiac arrest. Ellen Joyce Alter, a Detroit civic leader and bankruptcy lawyer, died on Saturday at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital in Pontiac, Michigan. She was 44. Her family said the cause was a cerebral aneurysm. Country music star Conway Twitty dies. Conway Twitty, who started as a teen rock idol in the 1950s and crossed over to country to become a star, died Saturday at age 59. Conway Twitty, age 59. David Houston, star at the Grand Ole Opry. David Houston, the Grand Ole Opry star who won a Grammy for the country music classic Almost Persuaded, died Tuesday at the age of 57. 57, Conway Twitty. Representative Paul B. Henry, 51, dies after battling brain cancer. Representative Paul B. Henry, whose hard work and moderate views made him a rising star in the National Republican Party, died Saturday at his home. He was 51. And then Richard Jordan, age 56, an award-winning actor and director whose career spanned movies, television, and stage, died of a brain tumor on Monday in Los Angeles. Dr. Helen F. Sear, age 57, brain researcher. Helen F. Sear, a professor of psychology, or physiology rather, at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, whose research focused on the anatomy and mechanism of the human brain, died August 11th at her home in North Dighton, Massachusetts. She was 57. Now, that's five or six or seven obituaries of the rich and famous. I mean, these people are doctors, surgeons, they're brain specialists, they're country western movie stars, they're in business, you know, CEOs. These are people with money who can afford the best medical care that money can buy. You know, not Joe Sixpacks like us. I mean, these guys have plenty of bread, and they're dying in their 50s, 40s, 30s. Why is that? Is there something that we need to know that we aren't being told? Is there something that if you and I had more information, maybe we could avoid dying at age 58. Well, let's take a look at this thing called pica and cribbing. You ever heard the word pica, P-I-C-A? Well, here in Wallach's book on page 53, he gives us a little clue as to what he's talking about. He says, obesity and overweight problems are synonymous with Americans. Nibble, nibble, nibble all the way home. Pica, P-I-C-A, is a seeking. It's a craving with licking and chewing behavior that has its genesis in mineral deficiencies. Interestingly enough, neither vitamin deficiency, protein deficiency, or calorie deficiency initiates this pica behavior. Nor will supplementing vitamins or eating sugar, carbohydrate, fat, or protein quench it either. Since American soils are critically deficient and depleted in minerals, it is no surprise that pica, cribbing, and craving dominate the American scene. America is minerally deficient. Dieters, athletes, vegetarians, meat eaters, embryos, children, teenagers, young adults, and seniors. The snack food and snack food industries are aware of this relationship between pica, cribbing, cravings, sugar binges, and salt hunger, and they use it to their advantage by liberally salting or sweetening their products. Unfortunately for us, our bodies temporarily translate sugar and salt consumption as a fulfillment of the craving for nutritional minerals. For example, if we're lacking in iron, salt or sugar will temporarily satisfy our pica behavior initiated by this iron deficiency. Historically, the consumption of salt to satisfy a pica behavior was of value because salt was not processed and it did oftentimes contain trace minerals and rare earths. However, today, salt consumption, although contrary to popular belief, is not in and of itself harmful. It does present the problem of allowing our bodies to think that we're getting minerals, the equivalent of the empty calorie diet. For example, processed food calories without any vitamins or minerals. Farmers and husbandrymen use the salt hunger of animals to ensure the consumption of trace minerals by incorporating trace minerals in salt blocks containing 85% salt. Anything less than 85% sodium chloride in a salt block will be ignored by the animals even if they have major mineral deficiencies. Cribbing is a name given to a particular form of pica. We find it in domestic animals. A good husbandryman knows when a horse or a cow cribs, that is, chews or gnaws on a wooden feed box, fence, hitching post, or barn door. The animal really has a craving for minerals. Such mineral-starved animals will at first eat large amounts of supplemental minerals until they're satisfied. Then they will automatically reduce their level of consumption to a maintenance level. Salt appetite is very striking in both pregnant animals and humans. Bizarre cravings are legendary in pregnant humans. From antiquity, the description of cravings or pica in humans relates its major incidents to pregnant women. The Hawaiian king, Kamehameha, his mother, Queen Kekapiawa, had cravings for eyeballs. Although she specifically wanted chief's eyes, she was given the eyes of sharks to eat. We have seen 100 pregnant sheep in Montana lined up along an embankment eating clay. This is a form of pica known as geophagia, or earth-eating. Geophagia is very common in minerally deficient pregnant humans. Pica, or perverted appetite, or irresistible cravings with the eating of bizarre or unsuitable non-food substances, or fattening non-foods, has been a curiosity for philosophers, doctors, and priests for thousands of years. Pica, as a symptom of mineral deficiencies, is universal in the world and has been reported in animals and humans of all age groups. In modern times, the easy availability of candy, sugared, high-calorie snacks, soft drinks, and other junk foods has led to obesity when people feel the deep cravings of pica. A doctoral thesis on pica by Augustus Mergillatus in 1701 begins with the definition of pica. He says it's the malady. Pica is called chitta in Greek. Its derivation comes from the name of the common magpie, because the bird pica is the Latin name for magpie. Itself is believed to suffer from some malady, because it flits from tree to tree constantly seeking food, or because it enjoys all sorts of foods. Well, a catalog of bizarre instances of pica is found by Mergillatus' thesis. In men, he recorded one individual who ate leather, wood, nestlings, and live mice. Sounds like an initiation into some college fraternity, doesn't it? A second consumed woolen garments, leather, a live cat, and some mice. And a third ate cat's tails and decomposed human bodies with maggots. In Mergillatus' female subjects, he recorded women who ate human flesh, including one particularly horrible lady who lured children with sweets, killed them, and then picked them for her daily fare. Sounds like a female version of Jeffrey Dahmer. The murders were only discovered when the woman's cat stole the pricked hand of a child and then carried it over to the neighbor's house. The most common description of pica by Mergillatus were of women's desire for mud and mortar scraped from walls, just like modern children, who eat caulk and lead paint. We have often said that children who eat lead paint are screaming for minerals for their mineral-starved bodies. Give them minerals and they won't eat lead paint. Girls who ate their own hair, girls who ate cotton, thread from their own clothes, raw grain, and lizards. Mergillatus also described pica in animals, including cats who ate wood ash and pregnant hunting dogs that ate unusual objects. Cooper, in 1957, in her classic report on pica, refers to several ancient and medieval writers who emphasized the occurrence of pica in pregnant women. For example, Aetos noted pregnant women to crave various and odd foods, some salty and some acid. Some, he said, crave for sand, oyster shells, and wood ashes. Aetos recommended a diet including fruits, vegetables, green vegetables, pig's feet, fresh fish, and old, tawny, fragrant wine. Bozo, in 1638, noted that pica occurred most often in pregnant women. Bozo saw pica as a physiological problem and is the first to mention iron preparations as a treatment for pica. He suggested 1 1/2 scruples of iron dross taken for many days as wonderfully beneficial for men and women. Bozo also noted the case of a virgin who was accustomed to devour salt in great quantities, from which chronic behavior she developed diarrhea and wasting. Today we call that Addison's disease. Christiani in Frankfurt in 1691 reported a woman who ate 1,400 salt herrings during her pregnancy. Leconte in 1846 suggested that animals eating earth do so because of a want of inorganic elements. In modern times, the substances frequently reported as eaten as a result of pica behavior in humans includes paper, metallic gum wrappers, ice, dirt, coal, clay, chalk, starch, baking powder, pebbles, wood, plaster, paint, chimney soot, hair, human and animal feces, kitty box litter, and cloth. Because of social constraints on our public behavior, most people under public scrutiny who display pica eat sugar, snack food, or soft drinks when they crave minerals. Many smoke, drink alcohol, or use street or prescription drugs in an attempt to satisfy a nagging underlying craving for minerals. Ice eating is also common, especially for iron-deficient children and adults. Worms have been reported as a cause of pica, and they have been blamed. Parasites, of course, can cause anemia and malnutrition by direct blood sucking from the host or by competing for food in the gut. The resulting anemia is, in fact, perceived by the body as an iron deficiency resulting in pica. Pica is more frequently seen in the poor and the obese. However, David Livingston observed that both slaves and the gentry developed pica in Africa. In Africa, pica is viewed by tribal peoples as a magical, superstitious behavior. Henrock, in 1831, attributed pica to paucity of good blood and a lack of proper nutrition. Waller, in 1874, reported that David Livingston observed many cases of clay and earth eating, a frequent form of pica in pregnant women. Orrin Gilka, in 1931, and De Castro, in 1952, recognized that edible earths might be rich in sodium, iron, and calcium. Gelford, 1945, reported that pica was common in Kenya amongst African tribes, living mainly on a vegetarian diet, but absent in those people eating diets rich in animal flesh, blood, and bones. Richter, 1955, reported Kirkham and Birch analysis of 20 samples of edible clay from Africa. Dickens and Ford reported that 25% of all children ate earth. Cooper in 1957 reported a 21% rate of pica in American children, referred to the Mother's Advisory Service in Baltimore. Landowski in 1959 reported that 12 children with pica had hemoglobin that ranged from 3 to 11 G% with a mean of 7.89%. The institution of iron resulted in a cure for pica in 1 to 2 weeks. And again, if children have sufficient nutritional minerals, they will not eat lead paint. McDonald and Marshall in 1964 reported on 25 children who ate sand. They divided the group in half. They gave one group iron and the other group salt solution. After 3 to 4 months, 11 of the 13 children given iron had lost their pica behavior, compared with only 3 of the 12 that were given salt. Reynolds, 1968, reported that 38 people with anemia exhibited ice eating as the most common form of pica. 22 of 25 had their symptoms of pica disappear after correcting with an iron supplement. Woods and Weisinger in 1970 reproduced experimentally in rats by withdrawing blood. The pagophia in the anemic rats was cured when the anemia was cured. It is of interest to note that pica or cribbing behaviors are not produced by vitamin deficiencies. They are produced by mineral deficiencies. Two-thirds of the 153 pregnant women studied by Taggart in 1961 developed cravings. The most common craving was for fruit, pickles, blood pudding, licorice, potato chips, cheese, and kippers. A craving for sweets, vegetables, nuts, and sweet pickles came in second place. Phosphate appetite was described by Levant in 1796 as the anxious search by cattle in phosphate-deficient South African pastures for discarded dog bones. They also chewed on wood and each other's horns. Bone chewing has been reported in many wild species of herbivores, including reindeer, caribou, red deer, camels, giraffe, elephant, and wildebeest. And we've seen elephant eating limestone roadbeds and large termite heaps as ready and available mineral supplements. A search for calcium-rich edible clays and soils and territorial disputes over limited supplies led to wars in tribal Africa. And it's been demonstrated that calcium-deficient weanling rats will consume large amounts of a lead acetate solution, even though they taste bad, when compared with calcium-fed controls. The Oriental diet is extremely low in calcium, leading them to habitually and preferentially eat bones. When Dr. Ma Lan and I were courting, she ate the bones and gave me the fillets, partially leached of calcium with vinegar. There is no evidence of a specific pica behavior for a magnesium supplement when laboratory animals are fed a magnesium-deficient diet. Magnesium-deficient animals will crave and eat common salt. Magnesium tastes bad enough that animals will die of magnesium deficiency-initiated seizures rather than consume a pure magnesium supplement. It has been suggested that recovery from a magnesium deficiency can be a very unpleasant process, enough so that the bad taste of magnesium supplements normally required for recovery exceeds the unpleasant features of the deficiency. A natural potassium deficiency is highly unlikely, as all grains, fruits, and vegetables tend to be rich in potassium. A potassium deficiency can be common in those individuals taking diuretics for high blood pressure or weight loss. Potassium-deficient rats are hyper-alert and lick everything, including their metal cage, lab equipment, from each other and urine puddles. It is of interest to note that even with a severe potassium deficiency, laboratory rats have a strong craving for sodium chloride, common table salt. Chromium and vanadium deficiencies are manifested by thirst for liquid, soft drinks being the usual first choice and water the last, and hunger for carbohydrates, such as soft drinks, coffee and tea with added sugar, alcohol, pasta, desserts, and bread. The munchies cravings for alcohol and candy cravings, especially chocolate, are sure signs of a chromium and vanadium deficiency. The preteen and teenage infatuation with snack foods, drugs, smoking, and alcohol appear to be the result of pica, because they are so minerally deficient, they are seeking something, anything, to put in their mouth that will satisfy this irresistible craving for minerals. God help us, through massive Hollywood film, television, newspaper, and magazine advertising, our culture guides our children to snack food, drugs, alcohol, and smoking, rather than mineral supplements, just as surely as the Pied Piper hypnotized the rats to follow him with his pipe music. All right, there's the story on pica. So if you have a craving, you know, you're eating a lot of chocolate, you know what your problem is, don't you? You got a vanadium deficiency. And the chocolate doesn't have any vanadium in it, any more than the common table salt has any minerals in it. Although there is a form of salt, we buy a pretty expensive salt that comes out of the North Sea. And it's naturally evaporated, and it has the minerals in the salt. It costs $22 a pound, a little more than the 55 cent a pound Leslie or Morton salt that you buy in the grocery store, which is a chemical composition. And what they do there is they take it out of the ocean down in the South Bay, in San Francisco Bay, and then they take all the minerals out of it and give you the sodium chloride, and then they sell the minerals in mineral blocks to feed the livestock. So when Dr. Wallach said, if you've got pica and you've got a mineral deficiency, you go down to the local feed store and you buy a mineral block and you put it on the dining room table. And every time a member of the family walks past the dining room table, they just lean over, give it two or three licks, and that'll solve their pica problem. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide every day, 7 days a week over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give out do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. But for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And we're reviewing the book Rare Earths and Forbidden Cures by Dr. Joel Wallach. You can probably get a copy of this book by writing to the publisher or calling this number, 1-800-755-4656. Again, that's 1-800-755-4656. Or you can write to P.O. Box 1222, Bonita, California, B-O-N-I-T-A, California, 91908. Again, that's P.O. Box 1222, Bonita, B-O-N-I-T-A, California, 91902. Wallach is kind of peculiar in that he believes that the ultimate test of a product is that the people who sell it use it themselves. So like the financial advisor who invests his own money in the same funds that he recommends to his patients. So I just thought that I would share with you this book called Rare Earths. Very unusual book, 500 pages. It's actually a text or a manual on the 90. I believe there's 92, I believe he says in here, 92. I'm going to write that down. 92 inorganic mineral elements that you need for good health. Now, of course, we know what we need, vitamin C, and without it we get scurvy. Wallach concludes that the reason you get Alzheimer's disease is because you have a selenium deficiency. In fact, in the book, he points out what happens with a selenium deficiency and what happens when you replace this deficiency with selenium. The symptoms go away. Now, it's a tragedy. It's a paradox that 3 million people in America have Alzheimer's disease, which is a selenium deficiency, and they go to medical doctors who haven't got a clue as to what causes it or how to cure it. And then there are a few out here, you know, like Wallach, who know what causes it and how to cure it, and nobody listens. And the reason's very simple. And in the next story that we're going to take up, the story here of the killing fields, on page 215, there's a reason why the medical doctors don't want simple, cheap cures to disease, and it's because it interferes with the cash flow. Well, think about it. Wallach says that you can take a mineral supplement. We're not talking about one a day, multiple vitamins from some pharmaceutical company. We're talking about a health food. Mineral supplement. And it costs you 50 cents a day, maybe a buck a day. If it costs you a dollar a day, it costs you $365 a year. But people don't have a second thought about spending $9,200 a year, which is $25 a day for health insurance. People spend $25 a day on health insurance and think that's perfectly normal. But if you suggested to that person that he spend 50 cents or a dollar a day for a mineral supplement package over here to eliminate disease, he looked at you like you're some kind of a stupid, you know. You're suffering from the terminal stupids. Now, I've mentioned this a time or two before, so let me say it again, that in 1918, 60% of Americans had no symptoms. They weren't wearing glasses. They didn't need a hearing aid. They didn't have allergies. And they didn't need bypass surgery, and they didn't have cancer. Now today, only 1% of Americans are symptom free. 1%. I'm happy to report I'm one of those. Just 1 in 100 Americans is symptom free. I don't have any symptoms of anything. I feel good. I'm an old man, you know, and I move around a little slower than I used to, but I can still put in a full day's work. I probably couldn't hold a job, you know, if I was out here, you know, on a construction site, you know, as old as I am and as slow, you know, if I was out here carrying shingles up on the roof, you know, walking up the ladder with a square shingle, you know, I probably couldn't handle it. So that's why old men with gray hair walk around with a cup of coffee in their hand supervising the young men who can still work. But moral to the story is, you know, I might be old, but I ain't walking around with a cane. Now, here in the killing fields, Wallach points out that we're firstly and ultimately responsible for our own safety, health, and longevity. We do not contract with anyone to keep us healthy or warranty our bodies for 100 years. The responsibility belongs to us, and we only seek health care when we screw up something along the line. Unfortunately, most Americans have given up their rights and responsibilities to a doctor, or probably two or three doctors, and they cast aside the simple needs of the flesh, that is 90 essential nutrients, and then they go innocently to the physician and the surgeon as a child goes wide-eyed and hopeful with a stranger offering candy to get into the car for a ride. A ride not of joy or comfort, but of kidnapping, torture, and murder. Well, back in 1991, a Harvard University School of Public Health study revealed that 1.3 million injuries and 198,000 deaths occur every year in American hospitals as a result of iatrogenic or doctor-caused mishaps or adverse events. It's called iatrogenic disease, doctor-induced disease. These iatrogenic injuries and deaths run from 4 to 5 times greater numbers than deaths and injuries on our highways. Out of 31 million hospital admissions in 1991, 1%, that's 1 out of 100, ended in disaster. I contend that's far too high when the Harvard study pointed out that 7 out of 10, that's 70%, of these adverse results or iatrogenic events were totally avoidable, and that 33% were the result of negligence. Medical injury is a hidden epidemic, declares Lucian Leap. He's a medical doctor and the director of the Harvard study. Hundreds of mistakes occur every day in a medical lab or hospital, many going unreported, unrecognized, uninvestigated, and unknown, and therefore uncorrected. Now, according to Dr. Sidney Wolfe, he's the director of the Ralph Nader-funded watchdog group called Public Citizen Health Research. In January of 1993, he said 300,000 Americans 300,000 Americans are killed each year in hospitals alone as a result of medical negligence. Okay, now notice he said there's 198,000 that die from iatrogenic disease, but there's 300,000 each year killed in our hospitals as a result of medical negligence. First of all, Wolf's figures are very conservative because Nader's group used the mortality numbers supplied by the medical profession. A neutral outside task force may have found this number to be only 50% of the real figure, or around 600,000. Now, if you want to appreciate how big a figure 300,000 dead people is, then we would have to compare Wolf's figures of Americans killed by friendly fire in American hospitals with our U.S. military losses in Vietnam over the course of the 10-year war, where we lost 56,000 for an average loss of 5,600 per year. Now, according to these figures, you'd have been safer on a Vietnamese battlefield where an enemy had guns and artillery and wanted to kill you than you would be in an American hospital. And so let me give you the statistics here. If you've got 5,600, then you divide that into 300,000. So let's just take 300,000 divided by 5,600. You could have been standing on a Vietnamese battlefield, and you'd be 53 times safer there than in an American hospital. You got that? Let me repeat that. These are numbers, by the way, from the early 1990s. It's worse today in 2006 than it was in 1990. But the Harvard Medical School did the statistics and did the numbers, and they came to the conclusion that 300,000 people a year were dying. Now, that's the conservative end. The truth of the matter is, it's double that. It's double that. But just using the conservative numbers that they admit to, you've got 200,000 dying from iatrogenic disease. That's where they give you the wrong drugs. And then you got 300,000 dying because they cut out the wrong lung. Mistakes. So if you compare that to the battle dead, and remember how excited people got concerning the Vietnam War? I mean, they rioted on the streets, burned down cities. They voted a president out of office and a new one in. Remember that? Okay. Well, if you took those 5,600 people a year that were dying there, and you compared that to the number of people being killed every day in American hospitals, you were 53 times safer on the battlefield than you were in the hospital, according to Harvard Medical School. So in protest to the Vietnam War, millions of irate Americans poured out into the streets. Students took over universities with weapons and explosives. A president was chased from office, and there was political anarchy in America for the last 3 years of that war. Now, where are the protests, and where are the protesters for these 300,000 Americans who are killed every year in American hospitals as a result of negligence? Or I could say profit-taking. If Sears Automotive Centers were to destroy 300,000 personal car engines every year by negligently putting vinegar in the oil pan instead of oil, there would be hundreds of lines to file a class action suit. We would bet our house on that one. Yet, there are no protests in the streets, not even a crazy street preacher, for no one protests a free service, even if it kills or maims a few unlucky ones. Prescribing for those Americans treated in offices and outpatient facilities isn't any safer than a hospital. For those hapless souls taken to the hospital, inappropriate prescriptions or multiple prescriptions are dangerous to 25% or more of Americans over the age of 65 living at home. Many of the drugs are prescribed to counteract the side effects of any ordinarily prescribed drugs. Did you get that? I mean, you people, you go over here and you're taking this drug. You're complaining about some symptom. The doctor says, I'm going to give you this drug. You take the drug home, and then it produces some different symptom. You come back to the doctor and say, oh, my God, now I've got this other symptom. And the doctor prescribes another drug to counteract the side effect of the drug that he prescribed to you for the malady that you originally came in. And on average, the people that are 65 and older, that's people like me, you and me, us old guys, you know, 65 and older, the Social Security set, we're taking 6 drugs on average. Fortunately, I can report I'm not taking any drugs. I wouldn't take a damn aspirin, for crying out loud, because of the side effect that comes from the aspirin, which is called stomach bleeding. But I just wanted to point out, here's Dr. Wallach comes along and says, hey, these quacks are killing 300,000 of you a year, every year that they admit to, plus another 198,000 that they admit to in another category. Now, that's a 500,000. That's pushing 600,000. We think that's conservative. We think it's really double that, 1 million people a year. I reported on this to you some time back, talking about this iatrogenic disease. Wallach has a whole chapter in here with names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. I think it would be worth the money. I don't know what this book costs. My wife bought it. I'll ask her. Maybe I can report that to you next time. I don't think it cost $25, but maybe it cost $50. Hell, if the book cost $100, it'd be cheap. For this one chapter, just this one chapter in here that deals with iatrogenic disease, it's worth $100. To me, it's worth $100. So I thought I would suggest that to you so that you could take a look and call the guy. You know, he's got a number. It's chapter 9 called The Killing Fields, The Mineral Deficient Healthcare System. Let me give you this guy's name and number again. I think it's well worth it. And keep in mind now that I'm not on the take, and Wallach doesn't pay me a dime. And if he sent me $100, I'd send it back to him. Remember, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is a public service, and we give reports here. We don't advertise. I don't take any advertising from anybody. And if you want to advertise here, I wouldn't take your ad. And that's because that's bribery, and I'll tell you something about this bribery here as we progress along. But let me give you Wallach's name and number here again. His phone number is 1-800-755-4656. And 1-800-755-4656. And the guy's name is Joel Wallach, W-A-L-L-A-C-H, P.O. Box 1222, Bonita, California, 91908. P.O. Box 1222, Bonita, B-O-N-I-T-A, California, 91908. And I think you'll be glad you did. Now, that's the book itself. Now, he also sells these minerals. And so I wanted to recommend this mineral supplement. If you're not, you know, there's other mineral supplements out there, but I think Wallach's as good as any, probably better than most. And he not only tells you what the problem is, he tells you what the solution is and tells you why this is the proper solution. Hey, I'm running out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. All right, we've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, talking about rare earths and forbidden cures. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.
Okay, well, I guess this is the end of the show. I wanted to add one more thing that I thought about. I've just done an edit of this, and I edited some stuff out that I didn't like, and reposting it, just in case you're wondering why these two shows are a little bit different. But one thing I found out this morning when thinking about what I was talking about earlier, about how to love God, one of the things that makes that start to happen a lot more is when he answers all these prayers and you start to get this real sense that he cares about you, like really the sovereign king of the universe is really cares about you and loves you. And the more you understand that in your prayer and asking for stuff and realizing that he's doing this because he loves you, for God so loved the world. And I think that it's really, that's really, for me anyway, one of the things that got me closer to loving God, as opposed to just, just saying I did, I guess. Anyway, that's the end of the show. I want to play these two clips that I was talking about. One, the first one's from Alex Jones, and it is the guy, interviewing the genetically engineered food expert. And the second one is from George Gordon, talking about the rare earths or the mineral deficiencies that I was talking about. You can email me at chris@conspiracyclose.com. That's chris@conspiracyclose.com. And you can support the show by your prayers. You can pray for me and my girlfriend Connie for whatever things you can think of, but certainly to keep me from giving you any disinformation here and all that good stuff. So I appreciate them all. Thanks for everything. We'll see you next week.